Ladies and gentlemen, recorded in Fredericton, New Brunswick, Canada, it's time for Bite Night Pick with your host, Frank
and Matt
Allen. And just like that, we're back and we're getting set for the UFC's return to Kansas City, Missouri, because coming up this weekend, featherweight main event, the former champ, Max Holloway, they were calling him the GOAT. He's coming off of another loss to Alexander Volkanovski, but he's taking on a fresh face up-and-comer in the 19-1 almighty Arnold Allen, as always, one half of your hosting duo, Craig Allen, Twitter and Instagram, Craig Allen, FNP, with me to my left, to your right, as always, Matt Allen, respective
people
socials.
In Kansas City might be a little mad about what jersey I decided to wear today.
Matt Allen, FNP, and listen, when it does come down to this card, on the heels of UFC 287 down in Miami, Florida, we're getting excited for this one. I mean, 14 total fights. You have a couple of UFC debuts. And I'm going to get this right out of the way right now. If you check it out right now, keeping score with Fight Night Picks, I did a preview of Gaston Bolaños. And if you've never heard of him, Matt, he was one of those guys. We previewed him on this channel before. But he's one of the most exciting Muay Thai strikers that you're going to find outside of like one championship. Making his UFC debut this weekend against Aaron Phillips. And there's a lot of Aaron Phillips in MMA. One of the Ultimate Fighter, but a lot of fights to really look forward to and a lot going on this week.
And you know what I like about this card too? We often talk about how many ranked fighters are on the card. This is one of those cards where it doesn't matter because the star value is still there. Think about a guy like Edson Barbosa in the co-main event. Is he in the prime of his career, let's say? Well, maybe not.
Not
but
at
still,
all.
He is a massive name in the world of MMA. Other guys up and down this card. Clay Guida is competing. I don't know about you guys. When Clay Guida, Joe Lozon, and Jim Miller fight, I'm normally pretty darn excited for it. So actually this whole card has a lot to offer in terms of name value.
I get a nosebleed just thinking about Ed Herman fights. He's going to be taking on Zach Cummings. The lone Kansas City-based fighter on this card is Zach Cummings. Let's throw it on over to the Fight of the Night screen. You guys know it. Hit up the comments section. Let us know who you have in the Fight of the Night screen.
Let us know down below in the comments section who you've got. It's time for the Fight of the Night with Fight Night Picks.
And when it comes to the Fight of the Night screen, you don't like to cherry pick off the main event. For Arnold Allen, his last time out, it was less than a Fight of the Night against Calvin Kattar. But for Max Holloway, it was one of those performance bonus dynamic performances. It really was. So Holloway versus Allen, you know these two guys can throw the kitchen sink at you. You know that one plays more defense than the other one plays offense. This is a big time matchup in the featherweight division.
It's a phenomenal fight. And the great thing about Arnold Allen is every time he does seem to get these increases in level of competition, he exceeds the expectations everyone had for him. So if he can go out there and put on a crazy performance against a guy like Max Holloway, who knows what the ceiling could be for a guy like Arnold Allen. The thing about Holloway too is he's kind of like Giannis in the NBA. He's just at that level where every fight he's in, you have to put him in the Fight of the Night screen because he's never been in a boring one.
Well, then when you really do think about it, I know the co-main event's going to steal a lot of the shine, but Edson Barboza's last time out, 30-25, 30-26, 30-27 against Bryce Mitchell. Man, I mean, TJ Brown versus Bill Algeo. What are both guys good at? Can they strike? Yeah. Do they get hit? 100%. Can they grapple? Yeah. Does one guy get taken out more than the other one? Yeah. This is one of those fights that I think if it's in the stand-up or if it's in the scrambles, both guys show up. And I know TJ Brown's done some interviews getting ready for this one saying that he wasn't quite into it, wasn't in the right headspace his last time out. But when he is and he flows, I mean, he really does match that Algeo energy. I think this is going to be an under-the-radar one in the prelims.
I don't think we're going to get a lot of feeling out process in this fight. These are two guys who are extremely active. And in the places that you had mentioned, not only on the feet, but on the mat with their own takedown attempts, it should be a fun fight because I don't think we're going to get a massive feeling out process. And I don't think there's going to be large portions of inactivity in between the bigger actions between these guys, so it should be a great fight.
14 total fights. You're not wrong until Saturday night. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in the Fight of the Night screen. So it's a second total card from the Paris of the Plains. The last one in Kansas City was a UFC on Fox card. Big Fox card headlined by Demetrius Johnson and Wilson Hayes for the belt. When it does come down to this one, 9 total ranked fighters, a lot for us to talk about, and we're going to rip right on through it. But if you're not already subscribed to the channel, we know a lot of you have so far. You toss a like on this video. It really does help out Fight Night Picks. Again, 14 total, a lot of fighters moving up and down in weight, 5 total. So a lot for us to break down, Matt. We're not going to dilly-dally with the pitter-patter. We're going to get at her like they'd say on Letterkenny. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Couple of bantamweight win streaks are on the line. We don't get to say that very often in this women's 135-pound division. We have Panama's own La Pantera, who trains with La Pantera, Jocelyn Edwards. She's taking on Czechia's own Lucia Putzilova. And you know Lucia Putzilova. I mean, she had Fight of the Nights in the UFC.
Exactly.
She got banished from the UFC. She went over to Octagon, went on a very, very tidy streak, lost to former UFC bantamweight Talita Bernardo. The win streak carried her back in, and last year she comes back, she takes on Wu Yanan, and she goes out there and finishes her, which is a huge surprise for Putzilova, getting that finish win after so many decisions outside of the company. So a great move for Putzilova, who's really switched things up, and not necessarily training in her native Czechia. She's been training for quite a while out of SBG Ireland. You have John Kavanaugh in the corner. You had that Conor McGregor lineage there with some of the pictures on her Instagram getting ready for the Wu Yanan fight. But of late, if you look at it for Putzilova, and I made this a big part of my tape study and my notes, the fact that she finished second in the London IBJJF Open Championships, and she really has made grappling a focal point of her game that not only won her the fight against Wu Yanan, but it seems to be a growing discipline that she's added into her overall mixed martial arts.
And I won't go as far to say that she is two completely different versions of herself between the first iteration that we got of her in the UFC and this newer one, but you can definitely tell that the grappling has been a huge part of her game, especially as of late, because when you go back and think about her fights with like Irene Aldana, that fight was primarily contested on the feet. That was one of those fight of the nights that you spoke about earlier in the video, and that was sort of the lasting image that I always had about Putzilova. It was, hey, she's gonna go out there, she doesn't really have one punch knockout power, the striking will look a little bit awkward, she's one of those strikers who, it's odd, but her shoulders are high, she holds her arms very high up.
It really was kind of like a Nosferatu type of herky-jerky striking, but the thing that I've seen out of Putzilova, and you might not like what I'm about to say, but I said this about Cynthia Calvillo, goes to Syndicate, cleans things up. Some people thought that she beat Lupe Godinez over the weekend, but for Lucia Putzilova, really able to move well on the feet as she's gone from Octagon and back into the UFC.
I agree 100%, but my issue is, it's not like that movement leads to a lot, and that's been the interesting thing, because she does have a game that goes, okay, I can give my opponents trouble on the feet, make them shoot on me, and then I'm their worst nightmare, or vice versa, they're a little bit more skilled of a striker than I am. I have the ability to then transition my footwork and my striking into takedowns, because we have seen much more of a progression out of her as of late. You brought up that amateur fight that she once had against a 17-year-old where she gets ground and pounded.
Putzilova went outside of the UFC, fought with Octagon, and during the pandemic, they tried to throw everybody a bone and help them out, and I say that because in the pre-fight build-up to that fight, Putzilova was arm-curling her dog, so it was kind of an odd one, but it was a weird mixed rule set where you weren't supposed to go for takedowns.
Yeah.
Teresa Bledel did. Bledel was on this past season of the Ultimate, or not the Ultimate Fighter, Dana White's Contender Series. She ended up losing in that bout when she ended up making it a little bit further. But when you look at it, yeah, I mean, for Putzilova, it's been a strange progression, but a nice one. Very welcome.
It has been, but think about a guy like Max Holloway, where every single fight that we ever saw him on the way to the title, he was adding this massive new part to his game. For Putzilova, she is adding stuff, but I do feel like there's a bit of a lack of synergy between some of the things that she's adding. I'm not disagreeing with what you're saying. It's just, if she was a little bit better of a wrestler, I think her game would look so much better and so much more complete, because again, she is very heavy on top. She does a really good job of getting, it's not really back control, but just kind of digging the hooks in, getting that back mount. She is very good from those positions. I just think the wrestling is going to give her some troubles, and especially against someone like Edwards, who, again, if Putzilova is going to win this fight, the grappling is probably going to be a big part of it. But if Edwards can use her own footwork and her own kicks to just keep this fight very far apart from her opponent, I could see her being able to have her own success in the feet.
I don't know about that. I mean, for Putzilova, spending time at Lana Gym and SBG, when you look at it and you look at how Jocelyn Edwards has lost fights in the UFC, especially those two, it was the wrestling and the grappling of Jessica Rose Clark. It was the wrestling and grappling of Carol Hosa, who could volume strike on the outside if she so decided to, but she had a lot of success with the takedowns.
Though.
When you look at the two wins that Edwards has of late, she had some troubles on the scale. She fought that one fight at featherweight against Ramona Pascual, got completely blown apart at the end of the first round in that one, found herself back into the fight as it went on. And if you look at it for Jocelyn Edwards, her last time out, missed weight at 137.5 against Jeon Kim, won a split decision. Majority of the folks out there, if not all of them, thought that Edwards had won two of those three rounds comfortably. For Edwards coming into the UFC, I mean, where MMA math plays a part, she looked really good against Wu Yanan, really worked in some of that striking. But Edwards, as I said, I mean, she trains with La Pantera, Antonina Shevchenko, who might have a trick up her sleeve, because she fought a two-round fight of the night against Lucia Pudzilova on that four-fight skid before Pudzilova was out of the UFC. Pudzilova, as you mentioned, had a fight of the night against Irina Aldana as well. So again, I do worry a little bit about the weight of somebody like Jocelyn Edwards. We know how good her striking is. She's really kind of based herself, not just in the States, because at one point she was in Iowa, then she was in California, like she was Robbie Lawler in Iowa. Then she went to California, now she's at the UFC PI getting ready with those Shevchenko sisters, and kind of a revolving door of fighters that do train there. You consider for Edwards, the volume striking is definitely on point. 164 to 63 were those strikes against one Ramona Pascual. So we look at the odds, and I was surprised. I thought, okay, Edwards is going to be favored in this fight. Much better distance striker. She's actually the underdog in the matchup ever so slightly. So we have a look at those topology votes, the famous ones. It's a surprise to us as it is to you. And even with Pudzilova, Matt, as a slight favorite, I'm going to say over under 62.5% Edwards is the favorite.
I think it'll be under.
You think it's going to be under? And apparently I have no friggin' gauge on this fight. 971 total votes, 70% Pudzilova, large majority by decision for the 30% that have Edwards, large majority by decision once more. And I guess the question really is, if Pudzilova's the favorite, if the fans all have Pudzilova, do you have Pudzilova?
I do, but ever so slightly. This is a very difficult fight to predict. And like I said, I think Edwards is going to win a lot of the moments on the feet. You might disagree with that, but I still think her at range with the kicks, it's just going to keep Pudzilova far enough away from her, because this is the one negative of Pudzilova's game that you can see in all of her fights. She reaches really far with her punches, and that does concern me. Not that she's a bad striker, because when her volume's going, it is like an avalanche and there's a lot behind it. But to get the car started, or to get like a lawnmower started, you got to pull it a couple times. But Pudzilova, she'll leave herself a little bit open, and I do worry about some of those spots against a striker like Edwards, but I don't know if Edwards is that one-hitter quitter that can really hurt her bad enough on the feet to then kind of dissuade her from going for some of those takedowns later on. So ever so slightly, I'll go with Pudzilova, and I'll say this. It's not because I think she's going to complete a lot of takedowns. I think there's going to be a lot of clinch in this fight, if I'm being honest, and I think a lot of those positions are going to be Pudzilova holding Edwards against the cage, and for that reason, I put Pudzilova.
You pull start the lawnmower, and then you shut the choke off. When you shut the choke off, Pudzilova really getting started. She's throwing hooks to close the distance to go in for the takedown. I like that out of Pudzilova, but the trouble is, when you take on somebody like Jocelyn Edwards, does she throw leg kicks? Does she throw body kicks as a teep in a roundhouse? Will she go to the head? She throws those kicks from so many different levels to keep her opponents guessing, to bring their hands up and down, to where if she can dictate that range, it's Edwards all day. I like the complete game out of somebody like Lucia Pudzilova, but you definitely let us know who you have down below in that comment section. Both of us going with Czechia's Lucia Pudzilova to get the win. 14 total fights on the card. The co-main events, Edson Barboza versus Billy Quarantillo. And if you're not excited about that, you should be. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. If you don't know, now you know. Set to make his long-awaited UFC debut, we have the Dream Killer, Gaston Bolaños. And if you haven't checked it out just yet, make sure you get a chance to watch our big-time Keeping Score video that came out. It is a standalone, I'm not going to call it a masterpiece, but it's a standalone video that goes all through the life and times of the forgotten chosen one that is Gaston Bolaños, going to be taking on the Dragon Aaron Phillips. And he's in his second turn with the UFC. And if you look at a matchup like this, Matt, I'm going to kind of hand it off to you because I really do hope people can check that video out. But when you look at it for a guy like Gaston Bolaños, I mean, all of his pro MMA fights are with Bellator. He had pro kickboxing fights with Bellator. 23-3-1 as an amateur Muay Thai fighter. He was an international and national champion. And I know he's from Peru, but that's internationally and in the United States. A great kickboxing record, 8-1 as a professional Muay Thai artist. And he had a Muay Thai fight over with Lion Fight. He almost got finished in that one, ended up losing a decision, goes into his first pro fight, he looks amazing, loses a couple along the way, and I know a lot of people are going to look at the losses on Bolaños' record, and they're going to go, hey, his takedown defense is bad, and his jiu-jitsu must be pretty bad. That's not necessarily the complete story about those fights, but when you look at a guy like Bolaños, if you want to highlight, I mean, his 2017 knockout of the year and his spinning back elbows are amazing. So Bolaños, the Muay Thai striker, and Aaron Phillips, I know he's got a Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt, but that isn't what butters the bread. His Taekwondo really is his foundational skill set. He owns his own Head Kicks MMA. And these two guys back in 2021, I'll throw the picture up there, they trained together. So pretty cool stuff and a little bit of synergy between these guys going into the matchup. But again, I know a lot of the shine is going to be on Peru's Gaston Bolaños.
It definitely will be, and that's for good reason. Because again, if you just judge a fighter by a highlight reel, he has one of the better ones out there. But when you do the deep dive and go back and watch his film, and it is so easy to find, he fought in Bellator. It is the second biggest organization in North America. It's an easy fighter to find. Like, you guys probably know who Gaston Bolaños is at this point, but if you do kind of dig a little bit deeper than just the big kind of spinning actions, he has great Muay Thai, he has good activity, but there are a few concerning things even in his offensive game that I do worry about, and a guy like Aaron Phillips might not be able to take wholesale advantage of some of those issues that Bolaños has, but we should still talk about these issues just in case they do come up in this fight and any coming forward. Bolaños is great offensively, but he is a fighter who gives up a lot of defense in pursuit of his own offense. And the thing too is, not only is it the wide base with his hands, when he's throwing, he's not a guy who's going to keep the opposite hand up by his head while he's throwing. He will throw with a little bit of reckless abandon, and Alex Pereira thought he had Adesanya kind of hurt, right? So he went for it. Not to that level, but you get an idea of that. Like, if Bolaños is having a lot of success, it's not that he can be his own worst enemy, but think about fighters like Merab Dvalishvili. I know his wrestling's at the forefront of his game. There's a lot of spinning back fists. Bolaños can kind of fall into a rivet every now and then of just sort of throwing some of the most similar techniques, and I do worry about that, but to his credit, like you had said, he's been off for a year, and he does have a great foundational skill set to build upon. Now, he is 30 years old, so if we don't really see the improvement in this fight, I will start to question if we will start to see it after this fight, but the Muay Thai is so kind of show-stopping that it definitely deserves entry into the UFC, and this fight against Phillips should give him the chance to showcase.
It's really weird for me, because Aaron Phillips, he came in, made his UFC debut 24 years old, UFC 173, lost to Sam Cecilia, he loses his next fight, he's out of the UFC, and he had 3 years off from pro MMA. And then he goes and he wins quite a few fights in a row, and his last fight is with Cajuns versus Cowboys 1, and in that fight to get himself back into the UFC against Ariston França, he gets dropped really on in the round, really early on in the round, and his corner is definitely the one that's holding the phone up next to the cage, and it's like, no, man, don't end the fight. And I'll say exactly what it was. Let him fight, Menard. Let him fight, Menard. And the guy keeps yelling at the referee, who I assume is named Menard, and they let it go on. I scored the first round of 10-8 for França. And then in the second round, França looks like he's going to finish Phillips again, and he runs completely out of steam, and Phillips takes over with the ground and pound and gets the win. He comes in and takes on Jack Shore, and he struggles with the issues that he struggled with when he made his UFC debut. Aaron Phillips, he could be very, very good at jiu-jitsu. We just haven't seen it in the UFC, but his takedown defense has really struggled. His striking defense has struggled. It's very, very fun to watch. Phillips can be a more active striker than Bolaños, which you might say, well, Craig, that's an insane thing to say. Go back and watch these Bolaños fights. Great leg kicks. The spinning elbows are there. The spinning kicks are there. But there's large portions of inactivities on the load-ups, and he can wait to try and find his perfect shot to the point where his opponent can really start to have success. And I picked out some of these fights, and I really did go into, again, a lot of detail on that episode of Keeping Score, so check it out. But the fight against Brandon LaRocco that he lost by submission. In the first round, he gets dropped by a right hand really quickly. In the second round, it's a spinning wheel kick jump knee that drops Bolaños again, and then he's really kind of in the abyss. LaRocco takes it down, gets the submission. In the fight against Daniel Carey that he loses, again, he goes, Carey swings a right, Bolaños ducks, Carey jumps guillotine, and he gets submitted. So for Bolaños, even in the solo Hatley fight, I thought there was a good argument that Bolaños won, even though large portions of that fight were spent on the mat. But Hatley kind of gassed himself out, and all he did was wrestle, whereas Bolaños, even off his back, was throwing elbows, punches, kind of like Bisping against George St. Pierre, only to a greater extent. But for Bolaños, unless his highlight reel good, sometimes the defense can cost him. Sometimes his own takedown defense can cost him. So in a fight like this, again, Bolaños isn't necessarily a giant favorite in the matchup, but at 30 years old, with the inactivities throughout both of their respective careers, as deep of a freaking dive and a rabbit hole that I went down in terms of watching these guys compete at so many different levels, I have a hard time making a pick, although I feel like Bolaños should win.
I don't want to oversimplify it, but we learned this a long time ago with Rick Rufus. This is a classic Joe Rogan story. Muay Thai, 90% of the time, beats Taekwondo because of leg kicks. I don't want to oversimplify that because Aaron Phillips is much more than a Taekwondo artist. Like you had mentioned, he does have a lot of grappling. He has decent boxing too, because normally when you think about Taekwondo, you think about a guy who has to use his kicks to get into boxing range. But when Phillips does play on his feet, not that he can't get clipped himself, but he does have decent hands. I go back to the leg kick factor of Bolaños, and is that just kind of a hill too steep for Aaron Phillips to climb?
And it's kind of funny with Phillips having billed as a Taekwondo fighter with a jiu-jitsu block belt, so like Anthony Pettis or Alex Morono, but Aaron Phillips, when he brings it in, really low hands, almost like a Lyoto Machida karate type of style. And Phillips has trained with Lyoto Machida in the past. I threw a video on keeping score, check it out. Again, you look at the odds, Bolaños is the favorite in the matchup ever so slightly. We're gonna have a look at the Tapology votes, and listen, surprise to us, AR to you, I'm gonna say over under 85% Bolaños, because he is a huge star.
I think they'll be under 85.
And they are under 85. 946 total votes, 76% Bolaños, 75% by knockout. For the 24% that have Phillips, it is 63% who happen to win by decision. I think Phillips has a great opportunity to get a finish in this fight over a decision, because for Phillips, four of those five wins outside of the UFC on his road back, they were by finish. Bolaños can get hit, can get clipped.
Exactly.
And if you hit him and you rush in with the jiu-jitsu and you kind of get him out of that striking mindset, you can really take over with your own skill set. But for me, I'm going to go with Gaston Bolaños. I think he can clip Aaron Phillips in the matchup, and I think he can have a lot of success with his strike.
I mentioned the leg kicks because I do think those are going to be the main X factor of this fight. I think if Bolaños can start to stifle some of the movement that Phillips does have on the outside, it's just going to make him more available to be hit. And I'm not saying Bolaños is going to hit him with some crazy spinning back fist, but you get the idea. It will make him more available to be hit, and that should swing the favor to Bolaños.
And before we go, one giant note. This is Gaston Bolaños' first career fight at bantamweight. He's never fought at bantamweight, super lightweight for a lot of his Muay Thai experience, featherweight as well. So eager to see the chin and the weight cut at 30 for the first time at 135. So giant disclaimer there. Make sure you check out Keeping Score. It is the forgotten chosen one here on the YouTube channel. It should be a lot of fun. You're going to want to keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. And as we always say, let's get into it. An all-Brazilian clash in the heart of America. We have Dana White's Contender Series vets looking to duke it out in the strawweight division. Bruna Brazil is making that UFC debut. She happens to be from Brazil. She's going to be taking on Dee Gomes in this one. And Matt, the funny thing about this is you might consider both of these fighters strikers. If you look at their gyms, though, for Dee Gomes, coming out of Piranha Vale Tudo, and that's going to be the Jessica Andrade gym, Carol Hossa, a lot of linkage right there with Dee Gomes. And when you look at it for Bruna Brazil, I mean, as good as her striking is, and she was a Brazilian and South American kickboxing champion before she made that turn at MMA, she trains out of the Fighting Nerds. And for Brazil, when I looked at her on her way up onto Dana White's Contender Series, and even before that, I mean, you know what? We might as well just throw it on over to a clip from Bruna Brazil when we talked about her on our Contender Series show this past summer. For Bruna Brazil, like Dana White's Contender Series second half of 2022, you could just call it LFA slash Dana White's Contender Series Brazil. So many fighters that took advantage of those Brazilian LFA cards this year. She did as well. Her striking really gotten her to the dance.
So crisp.
Takedown defense, not the best, but she likes to go for defensive submissions off of that and then somehow end up back on her feet to strike again. I found with Bruna Brazil, Matt, and we talked about all these different strikers that hold their hands at varying lengths, kind of reminded me of like a Lyoto Machida or like an old-timey striker. She keeps her hands like, you can't really see it, but now you can. Like right low down by her hips, but out like this. And she's always out there throwing kicks. My comp to Bruna Brazil, somebody that I found with a lot of volume, long, lanky for the division. Somebody like a Marina Rodriguez on Dana White's Contender Series. That was kind of the one that
I would
I kept
agree
coming
with that.
Back to.
I think Rodriguez might have a little bit more power. We just know a lot more about her, I guess. So maybe Brazil could develop into a talent like that. But this is a clash of styles. Again, these are the fights that keep Mike Goldberg up at night. He loves these. Because if Brazil's going to win, it is going to be a striking affair. She does throw really nice kicks, even though she does remind you of an old boxer from like the 1890s. She can throw in combinations. She has decent power shots. The thing I worry about with Brazil, though, is she is a kick-heavy fighter. Brazil won't immediately just pop back up to her feet. She will try to play around a little bit, work her own submissions, go for a sweep. And if Man is just heavy enough on top to be probably one of the better grapplers Brazil's ever fought, then maybe she can just make use of it, win enough rounds, go out there, fight for the submissions. I think this is an interesting fight just because the two fighters are so different.
And I will bring it back to Brazil Man for one time. If you go to Bruna Brazil's Instagram, she has that video. And it's like old, kind of grainy, and I thought, what the hell is this clicking on that? She scored a goal in soccer against the Brazilian women's national team. So, feather in your cap. That's I scored cool. at rugby sevens one time in university, and nobody believes me. But if I had video evidence...
Not against the national team, though.
No, it was not. It was...
Not the country known for soccer.
No, I was B team. So, yes, not necessarily the trouble that I had with Brazil, but the kind of glaring weaknesses. I mean, the strength of schedule was what it was. I'd say between these two fighters, Dee Gomes has probably the stronger strength of schedule. She fought Dudieva over with Invicta.
Somebody that had UFC
experience. She had an Invicta type of fight of the night. It was a knock him out, drag him out type of brawl where Gomes got dropped early in that one. Lost the first round, lost the second round, rallied as it went on. But when you do consider it, out of these two, when you look at them stylistically, Dee Gomes tends to brawl when she strikes, and Bruna Brazil likes to play around on the outside, really crisp, just fun to watch striking, where she doesn't tend to get hit a lot, even though her hands will kind of glide a little bit low.
They will, and I hate for my prediction of this fight to be just so simple, but Dee Gomes is quite small. She is not a big fighter for the weight class whatsoever. And I know we have the stats right here on the screen next to me, how Brazil is the bigger fighter. In my mind's eye, she's like seven times
but
bigger.
But it's wild because for Dee Gomes as a pro, she has experience at bantamweight, flyweight, and strawweight.
Frame does matter, though. And when you're 5'2" as a brawler, unless you do have the power of a Jessica Andrade or a John Lineker, it's really difficult to win all those in-between moments in an MMA fight. And the fact that Brazil is that kind of a striker anyways, like, she could go in there and brawl and still have a massive advantage just by the fact that she is so much bigger. Now she has the skills, or not even now, just she is someone who has the skill set to fight off the back foot, can fight moving forward, and I'm not necessarily sure if grappling is going to play a huge part for either one of these. I could see Dee Gomes going for a lot of clinches in this fight just to try to slow the pace down. I heard Juan Soto talk about this. Juan Soto hates the new pitch clock because he's like, sometimes you know you're playing at the game's pace and you want the game to be played at your pace. So for Dee, I could see her going for a lot of clinches to maybe get the fight down to her pace. If she is starting to eat punches from the outside, I just think when you boil down to what their styles are, Gomes is a fighter who is going to walk forward a lot, and she does eat straight shots, and Brazil can do both those things very well. I agree with you, neither fighter really wowed me with their strength of schedule on the way up, although yes, Gomes fought in the much more recognizable organizations. I just think for Brazil, the fact that her movement is what it is going to give Gomes a lot of trouble. So I guess I'll just throw it back to you. What do you have to go against what I said?
Well, when you look at it for Dee Gomes, again, I mentioned at least one of the fights was that Dudieva fight, which was a win, and Dudieva had a win in the UFC. She was 1-2, but the two losses, very good fighters, the one win, not the greatest. But when you look at it for Bruna Brazil, two losses on her record. Craig, who are they against? Jessica Del Boni, who was recently the Invicta Atomweight champ. She just lost the belt to Jillian DeCourcy. And the other loss, Ariane Carnelossi. And that was very early on in Brazil's career. Again, she's continued to get better. And why do I mention their gyms in this fight? Well, for Gomes, you know PRVT. There's not a lot of fighters other than just Hossa and Jessica Andrade. But for Brazil, out of fighting nerds, I mean, hey, who was in the crowd watching the fight for Bruno Brazil? You know him for his neck tattoo, his glasses. Who am I talking about? I mean, middleweight's own. Matt, come on, give me a hand.
I was thinking of middleweight's own with a neck tattoo and glasses?
Yeah.
I'm really having a hard time with this.
Come on.
I can only think like Cody Garbrandt with neck tattoos right now. I can't think of any fighters with neck tattoos.
You can't think of anybody. I mean, a guy that fought Gaji.
How long is this bit going to be, Craig?
A guy who fought Gaji Omar Gaggiev. Caio Bahalio. Caio Bahalio, a great guy to have in your camp. So for Brazil, she's able to round things out. And on her fight that she had on Dana White's Contender Series against Myron McMahon, who was a very, very small strawweight. In that one, Mann struggled for the takedowns, and from jump, Brazil was hitting that teep to the body. She crumpled Mann at one point. I don't know if it was considered a knockdown up against the cage, but that continued to bring the hands down, landed that head kick, and in Dana White's words, the best female knockout in series history.
It was very nice.
That she did have. So that was definitely really good. But if you do look at it, Matt, we consider the odds in this one. Brazil, the slight favorite. Dee Gomes is the underdog. You have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us, there to you. I'm going to say over under 70% Bruno Brazil because of how Dee Gomes looked on short notice against Loma Lookman.
I think they'll be over.
Think they're going to be over? Way over. 965 total votes, 91% Brazil, 80% by decision. For Dee Gomes, the 9%, a lot going by decision. So when you look at this, I mean, Brazil is heavily favored. The fans heavily have her to win in this matchup. Do you think she's going to be able to kind of circle away and get away from that power of somebody like Gomes?
I do. If Gomes had the power of an Andrade, then yes, I do think her style would be a lot better and she'd be able to work her way up the rankings quite fast. I just worry, there's a lot of fighters who have good boxing and they're very aggressive in like the women's strawweight and flyweight division, but until they sort of add that next level to their game, we do see a lot of them struggle before they get to the rankings. Think of someone like Macy Barber had all the hype in the world behind her, and she had a lot of heavy hands and good forward pressure, but even she has had to add a lot of other components to her game to actually find success in the top 15. So I hate to be one-sided with a lot of this prediction. I just think stylistically, the fact that Brazil is a fighter who is so comfortable off the back foot, I think it's going to pose Gomes a lot of issues.
And I mean, for Gomes, she beat Dudieva going into that third round, 2 2018s and 1 2017. She got dropped in the second round and then in the third round. Dudieva was kind of getting tired. Gomes is able to pull away. And Gomes, what I do like out of her is I've kind of seen that cardio stretch in some of these fights. She doesn't give up. She continues to press forward. The knees were the difference maker. That's how she finished Dudieva. She beats Rayani Amanda, who's now Rayani Dos Santos, and she's kind of gone on a run since she lost to D. Gomes. But even in that fight, little herky-jerky. I do like that pure striking out of Bruna Brazil. So in this matchup, both of us going with Bruna Brazil to pick up the win. A big-time fight and a big-time strawweight division. But in the main event coming up this weekend, Max Holloway taking on almighty Arnold Allen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Groovy Lando is back, and to quote Donald Glover, we're talking about it. Looking to make his first walk in about a year, Lando Venata out of Jackson Wink MMA. He's going to be taking on, I'm going to say it now, the former boy wonder, still the golden boy, Daniel Zellhuber. And when you look at a matchup like this, Matt, Zellhuber's UFC debut, it's going to be discounted based off of Trey Ogden's performance last weekend. And everybody in the comment section is going to laugh. How could you pick Trey Ogden? It is what it is. But when you look at Zellhuber making that debut, he was coming off a 12-0 run. He was coming off of experience with really good promotions and fighters that he had fought that they themselves had fought good competition. Now, they lost all those fights, but for Zellhuber, when you're 23 years old, 22 years old, like, you're beating guys like that, it really does show a lot of promise. And when if you go on to Golden Boy's Instagram, I mean, he's training at Tiger Muay Thai, he's training down in Mexico, he's getting ready Extreme Couture. The bright lights might have gotten to him in that fight against Ogden, because in the first round, it was kind of a stalemate. Both guys played at range, because if you do look at a Zellhuber fight before that, his opponents bring the fight to him. He kind of gets that dog going, and then Zellhuber's right into the matchup. It's just in the Ogden fight, there weren't a ton of takedown attempts from Trey. There was a lot of striking at distance, and Zellhuber just didn't seem to have that regular fire that we were used to.
You bring up Bahamondes. It was a point that we both talked about a lot last week. He's a long-range striker, but he likes to get a lot of his work done up close, and Zellhuber is a very similar fighter in that capacity. You look at 6'1", you look at a 77-inch reach, and you're like, wow, he must fight like Max Holloway at range with his boxing or throw kicks like Gary Rodriguez. Not necessarily. He is a guy who will, like you said, get a little bit ugly, and he does excel when his opponent brings the fight to him, and that's why I think it'll be really interesting to see what version of Lando Venata do we get, because Lando Venata's early success in his career was probably the worst thing for his MMA career. He had one of the most famous knockouts of all time against John McDessie, that like skip in spinning back kick. It was a piece of art.
Did Lando Venata have the best run with a bad record at the start of his career, 1-2-1?
Well, also, he fought Tony Ferguson and almost knocked him out 6 times in like 4 minutes, and it's one of the great short fights of all time. It's just Lando Venata was a guy who, if he was fighting someone way better than him, he was going to push them far harder than you ever thought they were going to get pushed in that fight. And if he was fighting someone who you at least thought was kind of below him in the rankings, he was going to look really good. But the thing about Venata was that striking really did carry him for a lot of his early career. And then he started to experience some losses, and we didn't see him be as active as he was at the earlier part of his career. And that's interesting, because Venata, before he came to the UFC, threw a lot of boxing combinations and went for a lot of double leg takedowns. Then he threw a lot of kicks when he'd initially come to the UFC. Now he started to transition a little bit more back into the grappler, a little bit more into the mixed martial artist world, do both. It's just been an interesting progression for Venata.
And that's the weird thing. And I went back and I watched our video for Lando Venata versus Charles Jourdain. I remembered bits and pieces, and I remembered an argument that we had, because I was hot and heavy on the fact that Venata wrestled in college, D1, University of Tennessee, Chattanooga. And if you look at that one, like, he only spent a semester there. Then he goes to Jackson Wink as a very young man and gets involved with a lot of really good fighters. Like, I'm sure you've seen the pictures of Venata and John Jones and Jordan Wright and a lot of those kind of Jackson guys way back when he had a ton of hair. And just a side note for this fight, Matt, if you go onto his Instagram, he's got the beard back and a little bit of the hair, so he's not looking like Walter White or somebody's stepdad. So
I like the shaggy hair of Venata. I thought that was fun when he was throwing wheel kicks and stuff.
I think it's pretty good, but the reason why I say Lando Venata when he started out, yeah, I completely agree. It was a lot of boxing, it was a lot of kicks. He went 1-2-1 to start his UFC career. He had had 3 fight of the nights and a performance bonus in his first 4 friggin' UFC fights. That doesn't happen very often. But as it went on, poorer competition he would beat and better competition he would lose to. And I know he had an early fight of the night with Bobby Green. They rematched. It was another fight of the night. But since 2018, that to me is kind of Vanata's only big, big performance. His Bobby Green fight, the second one, where it was a fight of the night.
Is he just Alexander Hernandez who's a little bit more in the future?
Like, you look at the losses. Mark Jacasey was able to control it. Yancy Medeiros was a win. Medeiros was one fight away from being out of the UFC, although Medeiros' last UFC fight was a lot of fun. The fight against Bobby Green, another loss, but that was a fight of the night. He beats Mike Grundy by split decision. Majority thought that Vanata won that fight. And then Vanata's last time out. Again, it was a big harping point of mine. That's why I wanted to go back and watch that. I said, hey, Vanata's going to go out there for the takedowns. And sure enough, he goes out there for the takedown, and he gets caught in a submission, and he loses the fight very quickly. So for Vanata getting ready for this one, I decided, okay, I'm going to see where he's training, because he's always been a Jackson Wink guy, but he's been training for this fight up in Colorado, and I threw down some of the names. He has been with Onyx, with Gaethje, and then Team Elevation with Drew Dober, Corey Sandhagen, Taiwan Claxton, so Eric Claxton with those knees over with Bellator, Carrington Banks, who you see in everybody's corner nowadays, but you don't see him fight anymore, and every week I say, frig. I wish we got to see him fight more. And then again, it is weird for Lando Vanata, this career arc. He's always kept it groovy, which on his UFC.com profile was a nickname given to him in an IHOP parking lot back in 2015 by Cub Swanson. So Cub Swanson, I think that's pretty cool. And if you got the Easter egg, I made the Lando Calrissian reference to Donald Glover at the start. But when I look at a matchup like this, Matt, Zell Huber, my one knock coming into the UFC was his takedown's not great, but are the scrambles being a big guy, he can really work his own jiu-jitsu. His striking was already somewhat polished, though he kind of would play mummy defense and put his hands out in a lot of his fights, which if you're a big, tall guy and you can lean back at lightweight, it might not get you caught. I think training at Extreme Couture for a guy like Zell Huber for a full camp getting ready for this one's only going to accentuate your skills. It's just, who's able to win out? Distance striking for Zell Huber. If it gets on the inside, can Vanata take the fight down to the mat? That's my big question.
Exactly. I think this whole fight comes down to game plan for Vanata, because I think on the feet, Zell Huber is a much more dangerous guy than his last fight probably suggests, especially against someone like Vanata, because again, we talked about this a lot in the Bolaños fight. It was, hey, he throws a lot of these spinning techniques, he does get wild, he gets hit as a result, and Lando Vanata is a guy who has taken a decent amount of damage in his career up until this point. I'm not just talking about the Tony Ferguson fight. Like, those Bobby Green fights were insane. The majority of his fights do kind of get into those chaotic moments, and I think Zell Huber could have some success there, but we're going to learn a lot about Dan Daniel in this fight, because if he isn't able to beat Lando Vanata, it will be interesting to see where his career goes from here, but I still think a win over a guy like Lando is a great building block for you to have your first win in the UFC.
Zell Huber, to keep it PG for YouTube, got the crud beat out of him against Lucas Almeida in the first round, rallied second round, rallied third round, and then when it came to that fight against Trey Ogden, -390 favorite, and he lost in that one. Zell Huber is a slight favorite in this matchup. Groovy Lando is a slight underdog. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Matt, surprised us there to you. I've been all over the board on this one so far. I'm going to say over under for Groovy Lando, even though it hasn't been good lately. I'm going to say over under 60% Vanata.
I think it'll be under.
It's going to be under. And it's just under 977 total votes, 57% Vanata, 84% by decision for the 43% that have Zell Huber, 64% by decision, 24% by knockout. And Matt, for Zell Huber, again, outside of contender series in the UFC, his just length and overall fight IQ was able to get him into these sprawl positions where he's so long to defend takedowns that he could then mount that offense. I wonder if he can do that against Vanata here this weekend. Do you think so?
I'm like 55-45 on this fight, if I'm being completely honest. I could see this fight go either way, because every time I do get kind of a sequence or a scenario where I think, okay, this is where one of the fighters could excel in, the other one kind of has the counter for it and could have a lot of success based off it. Ever so slightly, I will go with Zell Huber, because he hasn't taken the damage that a guy like Lando Vanata has. And I know Vanata doesn't have a poor chin by any means. Do not get what I'm trying to say as that. But we've just seen him get hit a lot at this stage of his career, and I worry if he can continue to get into those fights. So I think he can have success with the wrestling, with his cardio again. Hopefully I painted a good picture for how Lando can win this fight, but I'm going to go with Daniel Zell Huber.
Zell Huber, Extreme Couture, and then the one recent picture on his Instagram training his boxing and taking a picture with Andy Ruiz. Will it be the curse of Ruiz? I think it will be. I'm going with a Groovy Lando Vanata. I like that camp change at Elevation, rounding things out at Jackson Wink, coming into a matchup like this. And I'm going to rely on Vanata's wrestling, which I didn't, against Charles Jourdain. So it should be a great matchup, Matt. We're both split on the pick. You're going with Mexico's own. I'm going with the United States of America's own. Some big-time matchups on this card, Matt. And in the main event, Max Holloway taking on Arnold Allen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say. Let's get into it. Fight Night Picks fans, I did you dirty. I buried the lead and I waited until Pierre Rodriguez is taking on Jillian Robertson to let it go. Now, I did throw it out there on my Twitter, so if you follow me there, you did see it. But we have five total fighters on this card that are either moving up or down in weight. And we have one in this matchup right here. You can see it on screen. Jillian Robertson moving down to 115 pounds for the first time in years, and she's going to be taking on Venezuela's own La Fiera, Piera Rodriguez, who went 2-0 in her UFC turn back last year, wins over Kay Hansen and Sam Hughes, and some really gritty wins there, as well as on Dana White's Contender Series, now taking on the best flyweight grappler the UFC has ever had in the women's division in Jillian Robertson.
On a numbers basis.
Flyweight submission wins in the company's history. And I'm a little bit surprised that Robertson's moving down to 115 for this matchup, because the last time we saw her out there, she took on Maria Agapova. They had trained together at American Top Team. There's a built-in rivalry. And in the first round, Agapova won that round, hands down. I mean, every time that Robertson went for a takedown entry, went to close the distance, we mentioned it in the breakdown, she holds her hands out, she doesn't move her head, and even the commentary was saying she's closing her eyes anticipating these shots. It's really bad. She went for a couple takedown attempts on that high crotch single leg to where she was eating those Travis Brown elbows. She was eating punches. And then in the second round, Maria makes a little bit of a fatal flaw mistake. Jillian gets the rear naked choke submission, does not get a performance bonus. That was one of the most disgusting submission losses I've ever seen, and I watched it about five times yesterday, and it still makes me sick to my stomach.
Why'd you watch it five times then? This is the weird thing about this fight. For Jillian Robertson, I do worry about her at 115 pounds, and this is why. She actually fought at 115 pounds in her amateur career, and she didn't look good on the scales at all. This is a big point that they talked about on The Ultimate Fighter when she was actually on the show.
She missed weight against Hannah Cyphers the one fight before she went on The Ultimate Fighter, weighed 116.5. So, the last time she made the weight was in 2016.
Exactly. So that's just a point that has to be brought up, because again, it's something that she has done before, but she also hasn't been able to do it when she was contractually obligated to. So I will think the weight cut is a big part of this fight, because the Jillian Robertson that we all kind of know at 125 is a fighter who is very set in her ways. And I mean that with some positives and with some negatives, because like you would bring up with the Agapova fight, when she goes for takedowns, she will kind of go on her knees and get really heavy to try to pull her opponent to the ground. Now, when she's able to get on top of her opponent, she maintains that weight and that strength with her top position. She does a great job of busting up her opponent with ground and pound to then try to get to the back and use her rear naked choke. But the problem is, when she's not able to get the fight into some of those set positions that she does really excel at, this is something we talked about with Antonina Shevchenko back in the day. It was, hey, when it's just like doing drills, she's probably amazing. But when it's at game speed, there does tend to be a bit of a lag there. And with Jillian Robertson, it's not that there's a lag when it comes to game speed. I just worry about what version of her we're going to get when she's not able to get the fight where she exceeds at, and that's in the top position.
And for Robertson, again, a longtime American Top Team fighter, but she switched things to the goat shed. And I got to give a shout out to her coach. It's Asim Zaidi. He's done a great job. Like, really, that gym has continued to progress. I know Hannah Goldie trains there with Robertson. Again, former foes, because they fought in Robertson's pro debut. But they train together now. Goldie's going to work your striking. But when you look at it for Robertson, not just the win over Agapova that won over a lot of fans, kind of wins her over in that overall submission category, she headlined Fury Grappling number 6. And who did she take on, Matt? Rose Namajunas. And in that one, they meet in the center. Robertson presses it to the corner of the mat. Robertson grabs a leg, flips to the back, and chokes out Rose Namajunas by rear naked choke.
No threat strikes, though.
Really quickly, and Robertson looked amazing in that one. But still, it's one of the greatest women's fighters of all time, Rose Namajunas.
Oh, no, I agree. But still, I don't take that much from that. You have a fighter who really struggles defensively on the feet and on the ground, knowing she can't get hit. So she's much more likely to go for
and
anything.
For Robertson, the two fights where we've really kind of seen the game plan stifled, the one against Tyler Santos, she got ground out. And then the fight against Miranda Maverick. Maverick was just kind of step ahead on the ground. this just happens to be a Clash of Styles fight. Piero Rodriguez is one of the better boxers that you're going to see in this division. And the best part about Rodriguez is she keeps that lead hand out there to kind of paw her distance.
Exactly.
For a smaller fighter at 5'3", 63.5-inch reach, which I know is a little bit more than Robertson, but not the greatest for the division. But she throws in combinations, mixes things in very, very well, and has great lateral movement on the outside. And for a boxer on the outside, that's how she's won these fights in the UFC. And the older fighter, surprisingly, in this fight as well.
I just worry about her getting caught up against the cage in some of those scenarios. Because I agree with you. Rodriguez is the much more talented fighter, especially on the feet. And not only with her movement, because I do agree with you, I think that's going to be a huge part. Her hand speed is going to be so much faster than Jillian Robertson's that if she can prevent her back from being on the mat, I think she will have a lot of success on the feet. Because Robertson's a fighter who will throw a lot from the outside, kind of to try to corner her opponent to then try to get it down to the mat. Not really using her strike just for striking sense to win a lot of those moments. So I do think this fight is kind of an oil and water type matchup, to where if Robertson gets that top position, she's pretty darn strong at 125 pounds. So I can only imagine how strong she's going to be at 115 pounds, but with the huge caveat of she has to be able to make that weight successfully and still look good on the scales while she is able to make the fight.
And it'll be interesting too. Piera Rodriguez, for her last fight, she trained a little bit out of All-Stars, you know, them for Chimaev, Gustafsson, so on and so forth.
Aliyah Latifi.
Reza Madadi. See, I pronounced his name correctly that time. And Aliyah Latifi as well. Primarily trains out of Blackhouse MMA. You know that gym for Alexander Volkov his last time out, but Coach Kenny Johnson, who's been around the block a time or two. So when you look at this matchup, Matt, the odds are about par. Again, Robertson's had so many fights in the UFC. Rodriguez still young in the game, but even her win on Contender Series over Valeska Machado, Valeska went over to Invicta, won the tournament, won the belt over there. So it definitely holds some water there. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 65% Robertson in the fight.
I think they'll be under.
I think they're going to be under. You looked at these beforehand. 1,008 total votes, 53% Rodriguez, 83% by decision for the 47% that have Robertson, surprise, surprise, 72% by submission. Matt, is it Port St. Lucie's own by way of Niagara, Canada? Is Jillian Robertson going to get the win, or do you have Piera Rodriguez on the outside?
I have Rodriguez, but, and this is a big but, if Jillian Robertson looks fine on weigh-in day, I can openly admit I might change my mind by question mark kicks, because I do think the physicality of her wrestling could be enough of an X factor to where she could be able to get this fight to the mat and submit Rodriguez. Like, I know Molly McCann is not the greatest fighter in the world, but she is a very strong fighter who has good offensive wrestling of her own, has good boxing, has good power. A lot of the same boxes that Piera Rodriguez does check off, so I could see Robertson having success in the matchup, but I will ever so slightly go with Rodriguez.
Rodriguez also trains out of Ruka Sport, out of all of the gym's primary training partner, Sabina Mazo, but as well, if you go to Ruka Sport, Mackenzie Dern's in some of those pictures as well. So when you do look at the matchup, I'm ever so slightly going to go with Piera Rodriguez, just based on the defensive striking out of Jillian Robertson when it is on the feet. And if the game plan doesn't go 100% according to plan, it can kind of go off the rails a little bit. Robertson obviously looked amazing her last time out. So I'm kind of on the fence with you. I got to see it on weigh-in day for Friday. This is more of a preview than it is for prediction, so a lot of people are going to boo this one, but we want to hear from you. You guys help drive the show. Let us know down below in the comment section who you have in the matchup. Some great fights left on this card. Holloway versus Allen in the main event. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Name Picks. We always say, let's get into it. You don't get to say this anymore in 2023, but a couple of Strike Force and Ultimate Fighter vets going at it this weekend in the light heavyweight division, Matt. We have Zach Cummings, the lone hometown man, fighting out of his hometown of Kansas City, Missouri. Going to be taking on Short Fuse Ed Herman, a man who main evented a Strike Force show against eventual title challenger Tim Kennedy. So Matt, when you look at this fight, I know a lot of people, if you're a UFC fan and you join kind of like after 2018, you probably don't really know about these two guys. But for Ed Herman and for Zach Cummings, a couple of legends. And if you look at it for Herman, he came on the scene in The Ultimate Fighter 3, and he actually touched on an interview that he did with James Lynch not that long ago, where he said that he was actually supposed to be on the first season of the show, and then on the second season, he was going to go heavyweight, light heavyweight, and then ended up at middleweight. And he was able to go all the way to the finale. Like, Ed Herman, a pretty darn good fighter, didn't get the win over Ken O'Grove in the finale, but just like Forrest Griffin, Stephen Bonner, Dana White decided to sign Ed Herman anyway. He's been with the UFC ever since. He had one stint with Strikeforce after the no contest against Jake Shields, but he comes back, and Ed Herman, a company man through and through. But when you look at it for both these guys, Matt, I have a lot of points. I have a whole page notes and a lot of tape study on it. Zach Cummings is coming off a near 3-year layoff. He did an interview with Cole Shelton of BJ Penn last year where in the headline it said he was bedridden for months because he had a really bad herniated disc, and he talked about it in an interview that he did with JHK and one that he did with James Lynch, that this very well could be the retirement fight. And for Ed Herman,
I don't think Ed Herman's got 15 left.
For Ed Herman in the interview he did with Lynch, and I'll mention the publications, I just got to make sure I go to them. Ed Herman said this is the last fight on his UFC contract. He'd like to fight a few more times, but this could be the end of the road for these two legends. They should be on the main event, on the main card. So let's get that Fight Night Picks momentum going. Let's get that charge going for Herman Cummins, because I know I'm really excited about this fight.
It's a good fight. I don't know if it has to be a main card fight. Like, Ed Herman...
Show them the respect.
I'm just telling people what the truth is. That's what they come here for. Ed Herman is very slow at this stage of his career, and he was never cursed with speed, even when he was in his prime. But what Ed Herman can always rely on is he is tougher than a $2 steak. He has extremely good cardio for a 42-year-old. He's like your uncle on Thanksgiving who wants to go outside and play football, and he's way better than all you guys because he had a heyday.
No. We got to tell the story. So our uncle had... No, but he has some Zach Cummins in him, and he has some Ed Herman. He always had a bad back, and he could never move. And then all of a sudden, we said, okay, let's go throw the pigskin around, and he looked like his own legend, Emmitt Smith, running just down the field.
We've told this story 20 times. This is the thing about Ed Herman. We got to shout him out. Got a finger blown off by an artesian well once, because a guy was trying to help him, or he was trying to learn something from the plumber who had come over, and unfortunately got a bad injury, but luckily he was able to get it fixed. The thing about Ed Herman, though, is... He could be slow. He can be slow with his striking, but his chin and his cardio will eventually break down a lot of his opponents to where they're just not the same version of themselves after those first couple big rushes. But Zach Cummins isn't some one-hitter quitter with his power shots, and I know Cummins is an interesting fighter because he has good power, he has good hand speed, he has interesting submissions. He really is a very good well-rounded mixed martial artist, but like you said, with all this time off, and with him really going to Ed Herman's weight class, not the other way around, because Herman has fought at middleweight, but when I think of Ed Herman, especially how big he is at this stage of his life, Ed Herman is a light heavyweight. He is a very big fighter. So I'll be interested to see how Zach Cummins does deal with some of the physicality of Ed Herman. But I don't think Herman's going to have the luxury that some of his past opponents have afforded him to where, hey, my opponent's going to punch himself out. I can kind of pace myself early and then expect to really take over late, because I don't think Cummins is the type of opponent he'll be able to take advantage of that.
Well, Cummins, again, is really interesting. And I might have made the mistake, Cummins and Herman. But yeah, it was Cummins that fought Tim Kennedy over with Strikeforce. Then two fights later, Kennedy was taking on Jacare Souza. But for Zach Cummins, he's invested himself in the exact same thing that Ed Herman's done. Ed Herman's opened a gym in the Time Away. It was an interview with MMA Sucka that Lynch had done. So he's opened a gym since. He's become more of a coach with Fabiano Scherner over at American Top Team Portland. And he started his own fight promotion with a couple of other guys. It's Cage Warriors Northwest. They just had a show. So that's really cool to see Ed Herman set himself up for retirement. Zach Cummings has done the same thing. And I know Cummings, a longtime associate, Glory MMA and Fitness, his gym is now called Ignite Jiu-Jitsu and MMA Academy, but Cummins for this camp has gone over to Factory X Muay Thai, and he's had Mark Montoya in his coach in the past. But when you look at it, the guys that he's training with, okay, you have Julian Marquez, you have Anthony Smith, Cody Brundage, the regular cast of characters that are around that gym, but he also threw out the names like Dustin Jacoby, who's on this card, Josh Fremd, who's going to work here a little bit like Ed Herman. And if you do consider Rob Wilkinson, and then Olympic gold medalist Daniel Taylor for the wrestling. So Cummins has had one of those perfect camps, so it seems, for this one. But again, the back injuries. He's had this, he's had that. He started out at light heavyweight. Now, he had one light heavyweight years and years ago, but he was primarily welterweight, then middleweight when he fought Trevin Giles, moved up in weight, dropped him in that fight at the end of it with a hook, and then ended up submitting him by guillotine. Dropped Alessio Di Chirico in the last second of their fight where Mark Smith was like waving it off, but the fight wasn't actually over. Zach Cummins, as he's moved up in weight from 170 to 185, has kind of found the sweet spot in power in his last number of fights, but he's been off for quite a while. And for Ed Herman, it's been weird because in his last five fights, it's capped by that Jean Vellante split decision. And you guessed it, Moncton, New Brunswick, Canada. Most people thought that Herman had won that fight.
Who are these most people?
He won three fights in a row, beats Cummins, beats Ibrahimov, and beats Mike Rodriguez. And Zach Cummins was actually supposed to take that Mike Rodriguez fight, but it didn't happen. But Ed Herman's last time out against Alonzo Menafield,
He got beat pillar to post in
that. I'm not the biggest Zach Cummins guy at 205. I just think Ed Herman is going to struggle in this matchup for some of the reasons you have brought up. Herman walks forward. He does. Now, normally, he's an aggressive fighter in the way, not like Lomachenko. Like, Lomachenko's aggressive to force you to fight outside of yourself. Ed Herman's aggressive to force you to just be really active. But the difference is, I think he's going to walk into a lot of those straight shots from a guy like Zach Cummins. And Cummins isn't a guy who throws from his hip trying to knock you out with every punch. His power is quite natural. And that's why a lot of these knockdowns do, I think, come near the end of fights. Because not that he isn't tired, because of course he's tired too, but he's still very much the same fighter he is in the first round as he is in the third round. It's just he falls off a little bit, not like 50%. I just think stylistically for Herman, this is a very difficult one for him to be at 42 years old because he's fighting a guy who has very good accuracy with his hands, who can fight on the back foot, who has good takedown defense. And again, I just think the accuracy from Cummins is going to be a big part in this fight.
We'll have to see how the injuries play a factor for Zach Cummins. This would be a no play for me based on the inactivity, the injuries, the retirement talk for both guys. And for Zach Cummins, the first fight at light heavyweight since he fought for an MFC light heavyweight title against St. John, New Brunswick, Canada's own Ryan Jimmo. So rest in peace to Ryan Jimmo. But Zach Cummins making that move back up. He was 6-3 at middleweight in the UFC, 3-1 at light heavy, or sorry, 6-3 at welterweight, 3-1 at middleweight. So we'll see how he makes out at light heavyweight. Both guys, BJJ black belt. Zach Cummins got that second degree notch on his. He is a pretty big favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. I'm going to say over under 75% Zach Cummins in the matchup.
I thought it was going to be 85 Cummins, so I'll say over.
It's under. So 744 total votes, 79% Cummins, 79% by decision. For the 21% that have Herman, 69% by decision. And I think Ed Herman's got pretty good volume numbers in the UFC. And I know, again, think about this.
But that's going to go back 15 years.
Put it this way. Ed Herman was on the same season of The Ultimate Fighter as Hollywood's Tate Fletcher, Matt Hamill, and Michael Bisping. And Herman was on team Shamrock, Ken Shamrock. Like, it's wild how long both of these guys, but Ed Herman in particular, has been around with the UFC. I just think Cummins might have a speed advantage. I think even moving up to light heavyweight, even where the age is at, Cummins has those. And even when Cummins gets himself into bad positions and he's on his back, you never want to see a guy play jiu-jitsu at light heavyweight. But I think Cummins has most of the advantages in this fight. So I'll go with him here.
I think Zach Cummins stylistically, not that he's a nightmare for Ed Herman, but he does offer a counter to a lot of what Herman does well. Herman's the guy who can really take advantage of your cardio deficiencies. Zach Cummins doesn't really have those. He can go for a lot of takedowns. What I do like out of Cummins is he can threaten with the guillotine too when guys do go for that offensive takedown. So I think that could be a decent part of this fight if we do see Herman get a little bit uncomfortable on the feet and start to shoot for his own takedowns. But I do agree with you. I have Zach Cummins.
Both of us going with the returning, possibly retiring Zach Cummins. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big time matchups on this fight card, Matt, including Holloway versus Allen. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Matt Schnell, don't watch this video. Coming up this weekend, we have a couple of guys coming off wins over Danger Schnell. It's Raw Dog Brandon Royval looking to make the return back from injury. He's going to be taking on Mateusz Nicolaou. And Matt Nicolaou, low-key, one of the hottest guys in the UFC right now. Since he's come back, four straight wins. He's looked amazing his last two times out. Finished Matt Schnell. Didn't even get a scratch on him. Went on the microphone, spoke perfect English, and basically called his shot for a higher-ranked opponent. He asked the crowd if he should get a bonus, and Dana White said no. They didn't give him that extra money. So for Nicolaou, a couple of knockdowns in that matchup. Now taking on Brandon Royval. And since Royval came in, and listen, he was the LFA flyweight champ. He fought Tim Elliott, looked amazing in that one. Kind of been off to the races. And even for Royval, every fight since he's fought Brandon Moreno has been a bit of a step down because at UFC 255 when they matched up, that was a title eliminator.
Well, wouldn't everything be a step down from the champion?
That's what got Brandon Moreno his shot against Deiveson Figueiredo. You had the shoulder injury to Brandon Royval. And when it's coming into this one, and I'll touch on it a little bit more, but Royval coming off of a broken wrist into this fight.
It seems like he's always coming off an injury, though. And yeah, I feel like that has to be said at this point in his career.
Royval was supposed to fight back, kind of in the fall of last year against Askar Askarov. Askarov had the kind of publicized weigh-in issues, so Royval went back to training, broke the wrist in training. So now he makes this long-awaited return. He also finished Matt Schnell, but one guy had, what, like a barn burner round one fight of the night against Schnell, and one guy put Schnell away. So when it does come down to this one, Matt, I think it's a ton of fun, and both guys match up very, very evenly stylistically in different ways.
Well, especially in different ways, I will say. Brandon Royval reminds me of like a young, and much crazier Gerald Meerschaert. Now, I brought this example
if
up.
He gave him basalt.
Just hear me out. I had brought this example up about Gerald Meerschaert on a previous video. It was, hey, when you think about basketball, there's all these different actions that you run before you get to a score. GM3 has the scoring ability, but he does miss some of the in-betweens to actually get there. And for Brandon Royval, he is cut from a lot of that same cloth. Are the offensive explosions that he can demonstrate in the octagon incredible? Yes, they are. There is nothing this man cannot do in a UFC octagon. Spinning elbows, long-range attacks. He has good body kicks up the middle, too. We all know how good his defensive submissions are, like you had brought up with that Tim Elliott fight. Like, if you had any questions whatsoever about how talented of a grappler Brandon Royval is...
The sweep that he had against Matt Schnell?
It was nice, but that's the problem with Brandon Royval that we have seen against some of these top tier grapplers. He can get held down if you are more of a physically strong guy. Not that Nick Lau will do that. It's just a part of his game that we have seen. And when he is kind of flowing, even when he's having a lot of success on the feet, he can still get clipped. Like, I go back not that long ago to the Kai Kara France fight. I know Kai is an extremely talented fighter, but him and Nick Lau fight in a pretty similar way. They're both high up Muay Thai strikers. I know Kai, he has better footwork. I would say he's better at closing the distance with some of his strikes. But when he was able, after he got hurt by Royval, he was able to beat him with the fundamentals. And I know Nick Lau isn't as attached to those fundamentals as a guy like Kai Kara France, but I could see him having a very similar fight. And I know what that means. It means walking through the fire, getting hurt by a guy who has big power. And we haven't seen Nick Lau necessarily make it through some of those situations like a Kai Kara France. I just think this is one of those fights that not enough people are talking about for where it is on the card, because this could easily be a fight of the night by the time it's all said and done.
It's two top five ranked flyweights, and it's on the prelims. And when you look at it for Nick Lau, 7 wins inside of the UFC's octagon. And you saw the left hook, left straight that he was able to drop Matt Schnell his last time out. He dropped David Dvorak. And in that one, you think, okay, Manel Kopp kind of made David look human. Mateusz didn't even make it look close. And Mateusz, I know the two fights when he came back. And again,
Dustin Ortiz one clouds my memory a lot because Dustin Ortiz hit him with a head kick
knockout and it was over pretty quick. Yeah. I know both these guys, Royval and Nicolau, both have wins over Tim Elliott. Mateusz Nicolau wasn't as wild and crazy, but Nicolau made it look pretty precise. He also has that really close win over Manel Kopp that I mentioned before. But when you do consider it out of these two guys, does Brandon Royval have great offensive wrestling? It's not kind of bad. It's out of the scrambles. He's able to force errors into his jiu-jitsu. Does he have good jiu-jitsu? Brandon Royval has great jiu-jitsu. Does he have good striking? In parts, and the power's
offensively
amazing.
Offensively, he does.
Mateusz Nicolau has some of the best boxing you're going to find in this division. I mean, could you imagine if they laced it up boxing glove Nicolau against Figueiredo? Wouldn't that be fun to watch?
I think Figueiredo would destroy him.
It'd be a lot of fun to watch regardless. And Nicolau, again, it might cloud your judgment out of that Dustin Ortiz head kick knockout. And I saw a picture of Dustin Ortiz this past week. It was Ortiz, Michael Chandler, Gaston Bolaños. And when I saw it, I went, is that Fazeev? Like, he kind of looks like Fazeev with the shaved head and the beard. So when I look at the matchup like this, Matt, again, Royval's last time out, -260 favorite, got dropped by a straight right against Schnell to kick the fight off, which kind of scared me a little bit. When it comes down to this fight, Brandon Royval is not favored coming off of a bit of a lengthy layoff. Nick Lau is almost a 2-1 favorite in the matchup. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprise to us as they are to you. I'm going to say over under 67.5% Nick Lau in this one.
I think it'll be over. I think a big portion will.
And it is a big portion. 1,050 total votes, 78% Nick Lau, 68% by decision for the 22% that have Royval, 47% by submission. I'm surprised, and I know I set the bar kind of high in my own opinion, 67.5%. Brandon Royval is one of the fans' favorites out there. Twitter, our YouTube community, people love Brandon Royval, but apparently they're not picking him to win this fight.
I think Brandon Royval is a perfectly popular fighter, but I don't think he stands out as an outlier.
I think he's super popular.
I guess the majority of people think Mateusz Nicolau is going to... I just think Nicolau, and I said it earlier, the fundamentals are what give Brandon Royval trouble. Could he win by finish? Of course he could. He could knock out Nicolau. He could hurt him on the feet, get him into a scramble on the mat, take his back and choke him out. I think Royval could finish this fight in the first, second, or third round. What I struggle to see, though, is can Royval do enough throughout 15 minutes to win this fight by decision? I think Nicolau could win this fight by stoppage, but also by decision. And I think for that little extra wrinkle, that's why I have Nicolau.
And I like Nicolau in this one for his boxing. And I know he's a Novo Nyao guy. And if you look kind of closely... I know people didn't like the result, but in Luana Pinheiro's corner on the weekend, UFC 287, Mateusz Nicolau was there. Are they acquainted? I'd say so. So, Matt, when I do look at this one, I like Nicolau's boxing defense. He's got a good shell. And against a guy like Brandon Royval, I think those things can really carry him far in a matchup like this.
One of the craziest back pieces you will ever see in the UFC.
Oh, my. Both of us going with the man with no nickname, Mateusz Nicolau. You let us know down below in the comments section who you have. And now we're heating up, Matt. The next fight, Bill Algeo, TJ Brown. Possible fight of the night. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say, let's get into it. Couple of jiu-jitsu black belts battle it out. Coming up this weekend, Senor Perfecto out of, it's the oddliest named city in the United States, King of Prussia, Pennsylvania. Bill Algeo, he's going to be taking on downtown TJ Brown. And Matt, I'm going to lose the whole audience right here, but I want you to listen up. I'm about full transparency. I have a terrible time picking these guys' fights. And I went back and I looked at my record picking these guys. So Bill Algeo in the UFC is 3-3. And I'm 3-3 in picking his fights. I had Lamas to beat him. That happened. I had Carlisle to beat him. That didn't happen. I had Algeo in his next fight. I had Brito, Algeo. And then for TJ Brown, Matt, I picked TJ Brown in 5 of his 6 UFC fights. I didn't pick him to beat Eric Silva. And in that, I'm 2-4, so I'm terrible at picking these guys' fights because I'll tell you why. I know what their styles are, and I went back and I watched their fights, and by and large, I think I had a good synergy to it. But picking them in other matchups, that's what screws me up. Bill Algeo is a good long-range striker. He's good at his grappling, but Bill Algeo, kind of like Brandon Royval, got to take me down so I can work that jiu-jitsu. Algeo has good offensive wrestling. He doesn't have great takedown defense, but he's one of those guys that doesn't necessarily worry about the threat of the takedown because of how good he is in the scrambles and how good his jiu-jitsu is. Whereas, for TJ Brown, good offensive wrestling. Kid's got a motor, and it'll carry him far. Does he get rocked in his fights? Yeah, he does. Does he have really heavy hands when he throws his combinations?
He does.
Sure, it's more single shot than combination. So when it does come down to this one, Matt, it's a volatile fight to make a pick on, and I have a poor job making picks on this. We both do.
I have to say one thing,
though. Yeah, go ahead.
I agree with what you said about Bill Algeo with his jiu-jitsu, where when he does get into scrambles off of his opponent's takedowns, he can be really good. When you hold him flat on his back, though, you can hold him down for quite a while, and that's something. That is something about TJ Brown's game. I don't know why that was so difficult to say. That I do think he'll have a lot of success with, because, like you said, do both guys have that Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu black belt in their back pocket? Yes, they do. But Algeo's lack of wrestling, I think, in this matchup specifically, is going to really test him, because TJ Brown will not give up on the takedown attempt until you either submit him or knock him out, because he's going for a lot of these. And he does struggle with some of his defense, especially from the outside. But even while you were saying with Bill Algeo, I'm like, yeah, he is good at striking from the long distance. He's not great up close, though. Like, Algeo's great with those front kicks up the middle. He has really good straight shots, too. But he hasn't necessarily refined that Brian Ortega part of his game yet, to where he's using the knees, using the elbows, and really being able to use all of his Muay Thai to damage his opponent when they get into the clinch, because it is a very obvious game plan for a lot of guys to do. They see a long, tall striker who has good power from the outside and can get taken down. What are you going to do? Get close to him, try to use your boxing and take him down? TJ Brown's one of those guys who, that's basically his game plan in every single fight.
Yeah, I mean, Brown comes into the UFC, fights Jordan Griven, looks great to start, and then continues to go for long takedown attempts and gets caught in a submission out of one of those. Then he takes on Danny Chavez, and in that fight, Chavez with the leg kicks, with the striking, that was really the story of it. The fight against Kai Kamaka III could have gone either way. The fight against Charles Rossi looked good. Against Shayulan Nurdembeka, there were moments. TJ Brown got clipped in that one. And then against Eric Silva, Silva looked all right in the first round, but then after that, TJ Brown was able to just pull away, the old-timey wrestling, just arm triangle submission that he was able to get, and Silva just ran off cliff as it went on. But Bill Algeo, as you say, from Ricardo Lamas to some of the other fights, Spike Carlaw looked great with the similar stylistic game plan to TJ Brown in the first round, burned too hot, burned himself out. The fight against Hamosh, well, Hamosh took Bill Algeo down and was able to just continually go for takedowns. Herbert Burns got tired. The fight that he had against Joanderson Brito, he got tired after the first round, and then against Andre Feely.
Did Gilbert call his mom after that fight? She was like, how'd it go, honey? Herbert got tired, and then he just hung up and put it down.
Well, you better tell Herbert to grow out his hair, because I guess that's your X factor. But Matt, when it does come down to this one, again, I went back and I watched these fights. TJ Brown in the UFC has had no less than 2 takedowns in every single fight. He's got that motor. He trains with a high level of training partner. But I just, again, part and parcel, I know their games, going back and watching them. I just, Bill Algeo outside of the UFC, who are his losses? Dean Lavin in his like second pro fight, Shane Burgos, Jared Gordon, and then Brendan Lochner on Contender Series where he struggled with the takedown. So Algeo struggled against guys that take him down. TJ Brown takes down a lot of guys but gets caught in submissions and struggles with long range striking. My mind's eye, these two guys are even. The odds are pretty darn close. Bill Algeo is a slight favorite. We look at the topology votes. Matt, surprise us there to you. I'm going to say over under 60% Bill Algeo. What do you say?
I'll say over.
You're going to say over? It's way over.
I didn't think it'd be that high, though.
1,018 total votes, 85% Bill Algeo. I want to know what they know. On the 15% that have TJ Brown, 74% by decision. Is this the one where I go way off the board, or do I stay in line with everybody else?
I think this fight's going to go one of two ways. Either Bill Algeo is going to rock TJ Brown on the outside early in the fight. Like, I mean, early first half, first round, and finish him that way. Or TJ Brown's going to put on the wrestling shoes and go back to the well over and over and over and over again until there is nothing left in that well. Like, Bill Algeo does have good jiu-jitsu, but he can be held flat on his back in that kind of full guard shutdown position.
TJ Brown for 5'9", going up against 6 feet. TJ Brown's weight cut never looks good on Friday.
Good point, but I just think Bill Algeo's going to have to waste a lot of energy if he wants to get back up to his feet in this fight. That's my big thing about this fight. Algeo doesn't have the ability to just, okay, boom, you're off of me, Derek Lewis, just stand up. I think it's going to cost him a lot of energy to get back up to his feet. We have seen the power bar does go down with Bill Algeo. Like, the pop is on the shots earlier on in the fight, but they do get much more labored as the fight continues. And for those reasons, I'm going to go with the slight underdog in TJ Brown. Again, could he get clipped at any point? Yes, I think he could. I just think the wrestling is at least a base that I can rely on throughout this fight, and that's why I like Brown.
And Matt, we've been pretty darn high on Bill Algeo throughout these. I know as a guy who just said I picked TJ Brown in 5 of 6 of his UFC fights where he's gone 3-3, that's not the best, but Shai Ilan was able to clip him early in their fight. Kai Kamaka was able to clip him and drop him. It's happened. I like TJ Brown in the matchup for his wrestling, but if he gets dropped and finished by Bill Algeo, it wouldn't surprise me in the slightest. And this is the month where people just
take an L every now and then. It doesn't have to be a ha-ha. Just like, yeah, I'm wrong. We're wrong all the time. Just admit it.
All right, Matt. We're wrong all the time. Fight Night pick sucks. Both of us.
No. It's just like, we do predictions. We're going to get the right. We're going to get the wrong. You can't just be like, oh, everybody thinks we're dumb. We get the wrong. It happens.
Help us out in the comments section. Let us know who you have some big fights left on this card, Matt, including the next one. Hardcores rejoice. Clay Guida taking on Rafa Garcia. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night picks. We always say,
let's get into it.
Probably already been done before, but if they made a show about the carpenter, Clay Guida's life, they probably call it Clay Carpenter. Can't quit, won't quit. And the guy is more active than ever, hitting his age 41 season. He's going to be taking on gifted Rafa Garcia, the former Combate champ. Rafa's on a run. Clay's on a run. Both guys looking to pick up their second straight win. And Matt, for Clay Guida, you go back a couple of fights. He's taking on Leonardo Santos, my guy. And he almost gets finished in the first round. So bad. But the referee keeps him in it. The second round, my guy, Santos is completely out of it. And Clay takes over and picks up the second round finish win. He goes out. He fights Claudio Poyas. We said before the fight, Clay, don't go for a takedown. But Clay Guida goes for that takedown. He gets knee-barred by...
One of the more fun submissions you'll ever see. Just because, like, the way it happened, Clay's on top and then, whoop, no,
yeah,
he's not.
He gets beaten by Claudio Poyas in the first round. But Guida's last time out against Scott Holtzman. I know it's a split decision win on his record, but Clay Guida looked great in that fight against Scott Holtzman. So I don't hold that SDEC over him whatsoever. He looked really good against a primary boxer in Hot Sauce Holtzman, the former hockey player. And that sets him up well against a primary boxer. And I know Garcia's gotten some shine, even in his fight against Jesse Ronson with his own takedowns. And he's really rounded himself out. And that lends a lot of credence to the fact that Rafa Garcia is the guy that you bring in when you're a very high level MMA fighter, a prodigy or protege of one Cub Swanson. But for Garcia, continues to get better. Onyx Sports with Justin Gaethje, trained a little bit out of Elevation, and of course Ruka Sport. Garcia's continuing to get better. I mean, out of his 5-1, he's 3-5. Guida's 3-2. Guida's 3-2 as well. But Guida could have some of those answers with his herky jerkiness against a guy like Rafa Garcia.
You don't win a lot of fights based on herky jerkiness on the outside, and
unless you're Ben Rothwell.
But he threw, like, devastating strikes on the in-betweens, at least, when he was really good. Clickweed at this stage of his career is, hey, if you don't finish me, I'm going to be active enough to at least make the fight interesting by the end of it. But Guida doesn't necessarily have the same strength behind a lot of his takedowns that he initially did. He still has good output on the feet. That's not really something that has diminished, but a lot of fighters don't go in there with the fear that Clay Guida is really going to hurt them and clip them on the feet. Now, he was able to hurt Jim Miller for a brief period of time before Jim Miller, well, hurt him and then finished him right after, but I just think stylistically, this is a weird fight for a guy in Clay Guida's spot, because you bring up the Scott Holtzman fight, that's a perfect fight for a guy like Clay Guida, right? Holtzman had announced that's going to be my last fight in the UFC. Clay Guida's a guy in his 41st season, like you said, and he's near the end of his career, right? If he's in,
he's already terms, a Hall of Famer, is Clay Guida.
He's been around and done that. So for Guida, I like him in those kind of matchups with those other sort of well-established veterans. And not that Rafa Garcia is some unknown commodity at this stage of his career. I just feel like he's sort of in a different lane right now than Clay Guida. Because Rafa Garcia, two or three fights from now, could be fighting guys who are borderline ranked. And I know the lightweight division is very deep, so it's going to take three or four really impressive performances. But still, there is a path for Rafa Garcia to get to a somewhat good level in this division. I just don't know what a win over Clay Guida really does to him for this stage of his career.
Clay Guida, 2006 Strikeforce lightweight champ. Who'd he beat, Matt? Man with Bellator, Josh Thompson. That's who he beat. 2009 Fight of the Year in the Ultimate Fighter finale against Diego Sanchez. So he's in the UFC's Hall of Fame in the fight wing. And when you look at it for Guida, he holds a lot of all-time UFC records. Tied fourth at all-time with Jeremy Stephens. 34 UFC fights, third in control time. And third all-time in takedowns at 76. Mrab Dolashvili, two takedowns away from taking that record from Clay Guida. But when I look at this fight, Matt, for Rafa Garcia, pushes forward, throws boxing combinations, and will aggressively wrestle. And it looks like his gas tank's improved. But if Rafa Garcia goes out there, makes lightweight on Friday, and then decides on Saturday, hey, I'm feeling good about myself. I'm going to go into the pool. I'm going to cannonball. And as Rafa gets out of the pool, and he's just getting the water out of his nose and the water out of his eyes and the chlorine's still getting to him, and he surfaces and he opens his eyes, do you think he has flashbacks when he looks at Clay Guida with the beard and the hair and goes, oh my god, that's Chris Gritzmacher. Oh my gosh, I get tired in that fight. I hope that doesn't happen in this one, and then it plays a mind game on him and a trick.
You were dedicated to that bit. No, I don't think he will.
Okay, that's fair enough. Matt, Rafa Garcia is a pretty big favorite in the matchup.
Again, if Tony Ferguson fought Clay Guida, I'd be more in favor of that right now than Rafa Garcia, just because Tony Ferguson, for where he is in his career, a win and a loss to Clay Guida doesn't do anything for either one of those guys.
Rafa Garcia looked good against a young long-range striker in Mahashata, where the takedown was there, the boxing was there. We have a look at the topology vote. Surprised us there to you. I'm not even going to make it. That's kind of a surprise, though. So 1,061 total votes, 72% Garcia, 77% by decision for the 83%. That have Guida, 28% by decision. I have Rafa Garcia by decision. That's the least hot take. That's kind of a cold one, if I do say so myself. I have Garcia in this one because I think he can be active and land with more powerful shots in this fight. Guida does a lot of work from the outside, and he throws a lot at you, kind of like what Michelle Waterson Gomez did last weekend against Pinedo.
And also, you'll be nervous when it goes to decision against a guy like Clay Guida, because exactly, like, if he doesn't get finished, he does so much. Like, you're going to be defending takedowns, defending strikes, landing your own. There's just going to be a lot of activity throughout the fight, so I couldn't agree more. I have Rafa Garcia, and it probably will go late, but I'm not going to feel all that confident in Rafa Garcia in that third round, because we've seen Clay Guida not only get tested, but get tested late in so many fights against high-level opposition that we know he's going to make a great account of himself.
It's a tricky one. Both of us going with gifted Rafa Garcia. Let us know down below in the comments section who you have. Some big-time fights coming up in the main card. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
The two most prolific leg kickers in all of the UFC coming up this weekend. They're going to square off. They're ranked. We have El Guapo Chris Gutierrez taking on the young Punisher, 36-year-old Pedro Munhoz. And any chance I get, Matt, I'm going to turn red in the face and say change the nickname. But for Pedro Munhoz, his last time out, he was a big underdog. He fought Sean O'Malley. It's a no contest. And Matt, he landed 36 strikes.
They were all leg
kicks. 26 strikes. And all of them were leg kicks. And I say Pedro Munhoz is a prolific leg kicker. Against Dominic Cruz, 19, Aldo, 37, 40 against Rivera, 44 against Edgar, 32 against Aljamain Sterling. When Pedro Munhoz lands leg kicks, it helps set his hands up. Yeah. And if you saw the fight that Munhoz had against Brett Johns, and I know I'll mention the accolades that both of these guys have. Pedro Munhoz has a ton of fight in the night bonuses, performance bonuses. His fight against Brett Johns does not have any bonuses, but my gosh, that second round is wild. Johns is able to land combinations that rock Munoz. Munoz drops Brett Johns with a leg kick, with a body kick, and with a head kick that then hits a hook. Munoz, when he's on, he's on. And the best part against about him that isn't necessarily talked about, he's so accredited with his jiu-jitsu. He trains out of American Top Team. But when Munoz gets into some of those scrambles, like he did against Johns, I'm not getting caught in that sneaky calf slicer like I'm Joe Soto. He's able to get out of those bad positions, and he's able to find himself in either advantageous striking positions or his own grappling dominant sequences. And I know for both of these guys, if you want to play MMA math, they both have fights against a bevy of different fighters. Frankie Edgar, you had, for some reason, his last name's evading me, Gerard. It was Munoz's win that he had overturned. Gerard Sanders that he had in Halifax. He got caught for elevated testosterone after that one. And Gerard Sanders actually beat Chris Gutierrez. But when you look at this matchup, Matt, I mean, Munoz had a leg to stand on, quite literally, that he beat Frankie Edgar in a main event. Chris Gutierrez ended Frankie Edgar's career in devastating fashion.
It was sad.
His last time out.
There's a big X factor about this fight, and it just comes down to where Pedro Munoz is in his career. And I'll talk about this before we started filming. This has been a thing about Pedro Munoz his whole career. I'm definitely not the first person to tell you it. He is a very powerful striker. We can all agree on that. He has an absurd chin, too. I genuinely think Pedro Munoz is one of the most durable fighters we have ever seen in the UFC. He's never been knocked down in an MMA match. And he credits a lot of that to the boxing training that he does get at American Top Team. He's flown a lot of professional boxers in to get that one-on-one training, which is really nice to see from a guy like Munoz. But the problem is, he wasn't fast when he was 26. And at 36, I am a little bit concerned to see how much success he's going to have from the outside against a guy like Chris Gutierrez. Because you bring up the leg kicks against O'Malley. And yes, I think Pedro Munoz can land a lot of those leg kicks. But O'Malley, the one part of his game that he's very hesitant about all the time is the leg kicks, and that's something he's always going to prioritize more defensively than trying to counter off of, especially at this stage of his career. I don't know if Chris Gutierrez is going to be that hesitant about eating some of those lower body attacks, because Gutierrez, I know we're going to talk about his own leg kicks, he does do a very good job defensively himself, and for Munoz, I like the big actions. I just don't know if he's really going to be able to go out there and start winning a lot of moments to be able to win rounds. I think Munoz could win by finish, via knockout, via submission, because he is that talented of a fighter. I'm not joking. Like, when you just talk about skills, Pedro Munoz has every skill you could ever ask for. I just worry about that at 36, is father time starting to creep up?
And Munoz bites down on the mouthpiece and throws hooks when he gets in there, and in the Johns fight he gets hit, in the fight against Aldo he gets hit, against Garbrandt he gets hit. Like, he does get hit. His chin's just amazing,
so
it's gotten him to this point through his entire career. Chris Gutierrez, the one negative, and it's just one that I have, and then I'll talk about all the positive. It's like going on a first date from Tinder. They get in the car, and then instead of going, hey, you want to go get burgers and fries and watch a movie? It's like, hey, you want to on the way to, like, Wendy's? Because Chris Gutierrez shows you everything right off the hop. He'll throw you the fact that he'll show you the fact he might throw that jump knee. He'll show you the fact that he's going to go for the spinning back elbows and the leg kicks. Now, again, you touched on it, and I had it in my notes. He'll turn out that shin, and then he turns your leg kick into his own good defensive offensive. But when you look at it for Gutierrez out of all of these fights, the only other negative critique that draw on his record against Cody Durden coming in on short notice up a weight class, that really tall tie stance that Chris Gutierrez has, it kind of exposes his lower half to where takedowns are possible. And I know Gutierrez, as good as the last two fights have been against Bakary Danal, where he finished him by spinning back fist, and then he finishes Frankie Edgar. Before that, split decision against Felipe Klarich, who was able to employ the takedowns. He beats Andre Yule kicks that leg off. And then, of course, he has that TKO win due to leg kicks against Vince Morales. It's a big part of his game. Even in the Frankie Edgar fight before the knee, it was a big part of the game. And Gutierrez can play peekaboo with, I say the boxing stance, but it's with that high tie guard that really does work well. But against a guy like Munoz that'll rip to the body with his own hooks, that'll throw those leg kicks, there's just little parts and parcels that Munoz, if he has Mike Brown or Conan Silvera or one of those guys that have ATT in his corner.
We're talking about him like he's Albert Pujols on the Dodgers, though, and that's never a great time to talk about it, because Albert Pujols could still hit home runs, could still hit for average. He was too slow for the game of baseball, though, so he just couldn't play. Like, the thing about Munoz is
he was too slow before the pitch clock.
He has all of the skills you could ever ask for. He is still that fighter. But at 36, and after having all these crazy fights, it's a little unreasonable for anybody to expect Pedro Munhoz to still be the same fighter he was 5-6 years ago. It's just those miles do add up.
Yeah, and if you do look at it, even the Munhoz fight that he had against Jimmy Rivera, he'll wait there, high stance of his own, and then he loads and throws the big action. I liken him a little bit to a Piotr Jan in that way where he waits, and then he goes. When he goes, it is a little bit telegraphed. It's just if Gutierrez does a lean back.
He did drop Cruz with a jab.
Yeah, and it's a pullback with no big action, then maybe there's an opportunity for Pedro Munhoz in those actions. And don't forget about it. I know this is going to sound crazy, but I'll out myself now. I had Munhoz to beat Sean O'Malley with those leg kicks. I thought it was going to be a big difference maker. And in the first round, sure. And then there was that eye rake, the scratch cornea, and so on and so forth. So we get ready for this fight, Matt. Chris Gutierrez riding a wave of success. A lot of steam there. He is favored in the matchup. We have a look at the Tapology votes. Surprise to us there, you. I'm going to say over under 90% Gutierrez.
I think it'll be over. I really do.
You do? It's under. So 1,123 total votes, 86% Gutierrez, 69% by decision, 24% by knockout for the 14% that Munhoz, 72% by decision. So Matt, will it be skiing in the front seat of a car on the way to Wendy's? Or is it going to be a gritty win by a guy who's 9-7 with 2 no contests in the UFC and 7 bonuses? A fight of the night machine in Pedro Munhoz.
How good was Albert Pujols on the Dodgers? Not very good. That's my problem with Munhoz. Again, are all those skills still there? Yes, of course they are. If he gets the fight to the mat, I could see him having a lot of success. The problem is, Pedro Munhoz's only, like, takedown attempts come from him pulling guard off of either guillotines or him, oddly enough, pulling guard off a caught kick because he likes to go for heel hooks. Like, Munhoz is not much of an offensive wrestler whatsoever in his game. He does rely a lot on his opponent's takedown entries to then just start his own grappling sequences. I don't think he's going to get that opportunity, and I do think at range, Gutierrez is just a younger, kind of more explosive version of what Pedro Munhoz can do on the feet. And for those reasons, I do have Gutierrez.
I have Gutierrez ever so slightly, and I pick Pedro Munhoz in a lot of fights on the channel, but when I look at it for Gutierrez, do I love the boxing? Not necessarily. Do I love the volume? Not necessarily. I do like the fact that he can throw different looks at you. He can kind of smoke screen some things in there. The reason why I make the analogy that I did is the fact that he lands that knockout blow to Bakary Dana. He landed the same thing to Frankie Edgar True. Before he ended up finishing. So he will show some of these tells out there early. And if you do look at it for Munhoz, obviously a much higher level competition for a really long time. Brett Johns, the man's losses. Aljamain Sterling, Pedro Munhoz, and Danny Sabatello. He's like the Jared Brooks that we never talk about. And I wish he was still around. Matt, in the matchup, both of us going with Boss Rutan, El Guapo, Chris Gutierrez to bring the win back to Factory X Muay Thai. Matt, Factory X has Dustin Jacoby to come on this card, but the next fight, Tanner Boser. He's going to be taking on Iwan Kutsalaba. You're not going to want to miss it. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Oil Country, stand up! We got Bonnyville, Alberta, Canada's own Tanner the Bulldozer Boser coming in, looking Shred City over on the Instagram with his buddy Spencer Jeb, and he's going to be taking on Iwan Kutsalaba. And for Tanner Boser, he fought years and years ago back at light heavyweight against Nick Campbell in the Unified 18 main event. And it's kind of wild to see that out of a guy in Tanner Boser. That's one of two Boser submission wins that he has in that one light heavyweight fight. So for Boser, the little pit stop there, but now he's back. And he's a guy, even in Boser's last fight, you can see it from the graphic, 229. He's slimmed down. He's made all the changes by himself. Did an interview with All-Star MMA and JHK a couple of weeks ago. And I quote this from JHK. Is the PI helping you with the process? And Tanner goes, nah, dude, I just did it. So for Tanner Boser, just doing it. In deer meat to get ready for this fight. Now, I know Joe Rogan's big on the elk meat, but Tanner Boser, big on that whitetail.
Joe Rogan cooks the same thing for supper every day and thinks he's like Gordon Ramsay.
Yeah.
This is the weird thing about this fight. Craig and I were talking before we started filming. This is kind of the perfect fight for Tanner Boser to get introduced to the UFC audience at 205 pounds. And because, of course, we talk about him at the heavyweight division. Normally, he was the smaller guy who would have to rely on his technique, really mix in his kind of crafty wrestling with some of his volume striking on the outside. And that would carry him to a lot of wins against the sort of bigger, not as athletic fighters in that division. Iwan Kutsalaba fights a lot like most heavyweights in the UFC. I understand he's a little bit faster. He will have that edge because he's not as big, but he has really good hand speed, throws a lot of big looping combinations, and if things really go south, he can take it to the mat. Tanner Bowser.
Not if things go south. Yuan Kutsalaba takes it to the mat.
He does, but we've seen him struggle enough in some wrestling situations and grappling situations where I am not sold as Yuan Kutsalaba as like the greatest grappler of all time.
Let's reel that fish in.
Go for
Let's
it.
Break it down. Yuan Kutsalaba is a one round fighter. And if he doesn't get the finish in that first round, it's really hard for him to win once it gets out. And let's break it down. Let's break down his entire UFC career in 2 seconds. He's 5-8-1 in the UFC. Let's go down through it.
But it was round one against Walker and he got out grappled, and that's my only point.
Misha Cirkunov submits him, so Yuan Kutsalaba already at a disadvantage. He's 0-1 in the UFC against Canadians. And if you go down through it, he beats Luis Enrique de Silva, where he does a throat slit and then he rushes across. Gadjimurad Antigulov. Glover Teixeira finishes him in the second round. Khalil Roundtree's a first round finish. Devin Clark's the only fight that Yuan Kutsalaba has been able to carry things through an entire fight and show a better uptick in cardio, and he beat the bridge of Devin Clark's face up. And Devin Clark, as well as Yuan Kutsalaba, share one commonality. Yuan got dropped twice in a sambo fight against Azamat Mirzakhanov, and I'm going to talk about that in the next fight that's coming up. But for Yuan, you look at all of these big actions, and if they don't play out, he drops off a cliff. The fight against Dustin Jacoby, 10-8 in my opinion in the first round. Round 2, round 3, he was totally toast. In the fight against Ryan Spann, he goes for everything in the kitchen sink and gets caught up in a wrestling exchange, and the guillotine gets finished. The fight against Johnny Walker gets reversed, gets submitted. The fight against Kennedy, first round was kind of flat for Yuan, and then the second round Kennedy was able to take over. Ewan's gotta go for the takedown early in this fight against Tanner Boser. You look at Boser's,
I think he's gonna get tired doing that, honestly.
You look at Boser's last fight, and Boser's takedown defense is kind of tricky, and he trains at the great gym. I mean, Shea Bears, Hayabusa, a training system. But if you look at it for Boser, first takedown attempt by Rodrigo Nascimento, instead of defending it when Nascimento goes for it, he's defending it with punches as he's going down to the mat, and he's still punching once he's down on his back. Hold on. He holds a lockdown with both hands locked and both feet locked to wait for a referee stand up as he's on his back, which is troubling against a guy like Kutsalaba.
How much does Nascimento weigh and how much does Kutsalaba weigh?
Nascimento weighed 30 pounds more than Tanner Boser in that fight.
That's my whole point about that.
But we haven't seen Tanner Boser wrestle at light heavyweight, too.
Okay, we haven't seen him at light heavyweight in this organization. So, honestly, none of that... my point is, Tanner Boser, if Kutsalaba wrestles with Boser, I think he's going to get tired immediately. I think the footwork and the distance striking of Boser is really going to cause Kutsalaba issues. What I do think Kutsalaba can have success in is, if he gets Boser up against the cage, go into the Hulk mode that you used to go in. I think if he throws flurries like he did against Gadjimurad Antigulov, he can have similar success because Boser doesn't have an active defense. He will hold his hands up and he can get hurt by some bigger shots. Now, I'm very curious to see what version of him we're going to get at 205 pounds because this isn't a jump between bantamweight and featherweight where it's only 10 pounds or even middleweight and light heavyweight where it's 20 pounds. Tanner Boser is cutting down and he will be a massive fighter in this division, and that's the big point I want to bring up. That's why I don't really look that deep into the Nascimento fight because he fought a guy who outweighed him by 40 pounds. Now, he's probably going to outweigh his opponent by at least 10 to 15, so I don't think Boser is going to have those same problems that we have seen in the past with his defensive wrestling.
We're going to see if Boser is able to go out there and if it's going to be like a light up bit of success like a Jared Cannonier moving down in weight, or if it's going to end up like Justin Ledette, who went 3-0 when he started off his UFC career. And then he went out and he lost two, Rakic, Cammer, Walker, and Jacoby. And that was that for Justin Ledette, who had hand speed, he had size, he was able to do a lot of
Boser
stuff.
Boser had a lot more success in the UFC though than Ledette.
And Boser was able to do it outside of the organization as well. And he was one of those early interviews when he was over with ACB, with the channel, with Fight Night Picks. So definitely a guy that's been on the radar here with the channel. His boxing's great on the outside. His movement, his hand speed, his level changes, and his leg kicks. All big things to look out for from Tanner Boser in the matchup. He's actually the slight underdog in the fight against Yuan Kutsalaba. And I'll update those. Yeah, Kutsalaba, but a minus 125. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. Surprise us there to you. Kutsalaba went 0-3 in 2021, so he's looking to regain some glory. I'm going to say over-under in this one, Matt. 67.5% Tanner Boser, the underdog.
It's 50-50 to me, so I'll say under.
It's over. It's over. I'm very surprised. 1,070 total votes, 70% Boser, 80% by knockout. For the 30% that have Kutsalaba, 52% by knockout. It's a huge surprise to me. Usually the fans on Tapology and the odds kind of run the same way. So when it's different, it's a surprise. Do you have the Canadian in this one?
Ever so slightly. This fight to me is complete pick 'em odds. Like, I think the odds will be even by the time the fight night does come around because they are so close right now. But we are, again, we're going to learn so much about this fight on Friday during the weigh-ins, because if Tanner Boser looks like a shell of himself, and he just looks like some husk, I don't think he will. I'm just saying, if that does happen, then I'll be very concerned about how his gas tank's going to hold up, because that was the thing that really did make him special kind of at the heavyweight division. He wouldn't get tired. He'd fight at the very similar pace. So I think if he can maintain all those similar attributes, he'll have success in this matchup against Kutalaba. But again, I brought it up at the start for that reason. I think this is the perfect light heavyweight introduction to the UFC audience that Tanner Boser needs.
And I mean, I mentioned Kutsalaba getting rocked and dropped twice against Mirzakhanov, a 2012 European Sambo champion all the way, did the damn thing. For Boser, if you do look at it, the weight cut looks great over on his Instagram, 100%. You got to credit the guy for doing that. And when you do consider for Boser in a matchup like this, will the power, will the speed, will we see those advantages like
we're able to see by decision
at like, heavyweight?
Tanner Boser was a big puncher.
I think Kutsalaba goes out there, gets a takedown really early and mixes it up and makes it spicy. And for that reason, I like Iwan Kutsalaba in the fight. I think another camp at Extreme Couture should hopefully show up and show out, training with fellow Moldovan Sergey Spivak and some of the big guys in that gym. I think it's going to do great things for him. I've been wrong before, not to say I will be this time, but Matt, in this one, we're split on the pick. You're going East Coast to the West Coast with the Tanner Boser pick. I'm going with Moldova's own, the Hulk, Iwan Kutsalaba. This is going to be a very contentious pick, I'm sure, down in the comments section. So let us know who you have down below. Big time fights left on this card, Matt. A couple of them left. You're not going to want to miss them. Keep them locked in with Fight Night Picks, as we always say.
Let's get into it.
Light heavyweight card. I mean, coming up this weekend, we have the Hanyak, Dustin Jacoby representing Factory X Muay Thai, and he's going to be taking on a guy whose nickname is strange. It's the professional Azamat Mirzakhanov. And Matt, when you look at this matchup, clash of styles. And I know that might sound completely wild because of Mirzakhanov going out there. He's finishing guys with his hands, Mirzakhanov's base is combat sambo. And if you look at it, I mentioned it in the video before this, Tanner Boser taking on Iwan Kutsalaba. Mirzakhanov beat Iwan Kutsalaba in a sambo match. You might go, oh, well, Craig, sambo. I mean, Blagoy Ivanov beat Fedor. Blagoy's not Fedor. No, it's not. But you're wearing like a gi and you're going out there wearing MMA gloves and striking. And Mirzakhanov, the first time, throws a left hook, lands a knockdown. The second time, right hook, left hook, it's a knockdown. Mirzakhanov's one of those special fighters, and he's been on UFC fans' radars for a long time. He was signed with the promotion, supposed to fight Joachim Christensen back at UFC Fight Night. Don't talk about my mom. Chiesa versus Lee, and he tested positive for boldenone and its metabolites. So he was due to fight back in September 2019, or that's when USADA allowed him to fight back around the UFC banner. He spent some time getting ready with Brave CF, won an openweight championship against the guy that, if you're a PFL fan, you saw the win over Fakhretdin, who just lost on the PFL. But Mirzakhanov beats Fakhretdin, goes over to Dana White's Contender Series, fights Mateo Scheffel, who also fights with the PFL. And in that one, first round, nothing burger, until Mirzakhanov lands the knockout blow. Then Mirzakhanov goes out there, makes his UFC debut, and we're talking about a level of opponent where we're building him up. He fights Stefan Chukwe. Going into the third round, Matt, two judges, 19-19. Other judge, 2018, in Chukwe. What happened? Mirzakhanov, wait, load, land the left hand. And his left hand is either straight or a hook, and he does such a good job. But
and he's not a big guy either, but he's got big pop in that
hand. He looks like a middleweight, but Azamat just kind of rocks on the outside, doesn't throw a jab, doesn't throw a ton of kicks, although his head kick's pretty good. But he waits, left hand to that jump knee, he finishes Chukwe. And Mirzakhanov's last time out, you're going to remember it for Fight Night Picks takes Mirzakhanov. Everybody laughs. But if you go back and watch that fight, first round, nothing burger again. Mirzakhanov lands the straight left, lands the overhand left. That's about it for the first 4 minutes and a half of that round. Then Devin Clark lands a head kick and rocks Mirzakhanov into a takedown attempt. Second round, it's the left hands where Mirzakhanov landed, and Devin Clark didn't look like he wanted to be around anymore. Like Carl Havoc on I Think You Should Leave.
I just don't want to be here.
Then in the third round, you might think, okay, Devin Clark looks so bad in the second round. How did Azamat win it? Well, he landed a hook to the body that dropped Devin Clark, and he got the win. So Mirzakhanov still looks amazing, undefeated, just turned 34 this week. So happy birthday. Get a kazoo out there and a birthday hat. But Mirzakhanov coming into this fight, again, the reason why I say it's a clash of styles, Dustin Jacoby fought, Canadian Simon Marcus twice over with Glory and got knocked out by Alex Pereira. But even Dustin Jacoby he's come so far from, like, the Clifford Starks fight that he had his first time in the UFC to the guy that we've seen on this giant win streak that the judges took from his last time.
And if OPS Plus was an MMA stat, like, it's not. You guys have no idea what this is. In baseball, you can judge players by errors because basically what you do is put everybody's OPS together, you figure out what the average is, and then the average is 100. Anything above 100 means you're good. Anything below 100 means that you're bad. Yeah. Just... Dustin Jacoby would have an OPS above 100 with his striking. Like, if we judge striking in those numbers, he's a very talented striker with his technique, with his power, with the way that he can go downhill with his combinations. But he does leave the opening for a guy like Mirzakhanov to land some of those bigger hooks from the outside. But I bring up the size because I do think that would be a factor in this fight. Jacoby is a big guy for this division. We've even seen him match up against other big light heavyweights. Even up in heavyweight, I can't remember his name all of a sudden. But Dustin Jacoby fares very well. I'm going to feel stupid here in 2 seconds. Max Gracian. Gracian is massive. And Jacoby was really able to do a good job physically with a guy like Gracian. So I don't think Jacoby's going to struggle with Mirzakhanov in that capacity. But it is interesting. A, I like the nickname The Professional. Do you?
No, I hate it.
Really? I like it. This is why I think, like, The Professional, like, there's a lot of
like
hitmen.
The movie?
But there's only one John Wick. You know, like, he's The Professional. Like, there's a lot of guys who do Sambo. I'm The Professional, though. I think it's a fun
nickname.
Yeah,
it'd be cool if he ever talked. He never talks. He doesn't do anything. Like, he's just, I'm The Professional. I show up and I win. That's it. It's kind of lame.
We don't say that about anybody else's nickname when we talk about that, though. So, don't know why that matters. I just think for Mirzakhanov, he does have all the skills that should pose a guy like Jacoby trouble. Because Jacoby, when he moves backwards, if there's the threat of the takedown, he won't throw a lot of volume. But if you're just moving forward trying to strike with him, he is perfectly fine with moving backwards while he strikes. So, I do think for Mirzakhanov, his ability to switch ranges should be able to help him a lot. But if we do see that kind of inactive on the outside, that leaves the window wide open for Jacoby to just walk forward, not do anything wild, but just be a patient kickboxer.
You bring up guys on this card. Pedro Munhoz throws a cracking leg kick, and even in his resets, because he'll do the little spinorama, he doesn't really tend to take a ton of damage. Chris Gutierrez, who trains at Dustin Jacoby's gym, throws really quick leg kicks. There's a little bit of a reset, but it's just so fast. Alex Pereira throws them where there's not a lot of upper body movement, so it camouflages that. You saw that in the first round against Adesanya. And then the second round, he got finished. Out of Dustin Jacoby, there's a big windup, but he's so far on the outside that it doesn't give his opponents time to get within the range to then really land on him. So Mirzakhanov's lack of volume is what scared me in the fight against Devin Clark. That's why I thought Clark was going to win. Boy, was I wrong. And I didn't think Devin Clark was going to react like that to like a couple of left hands. But it goes to show you the power of Mirzakhanov. Sure. Will Dustin Jacoby be able to go out there and purely strike with Azamat Mirzakhanov? That's a big question. And will Mirzakhanov, coming out of K-Dojo Warrior Tribe, a gym where you remember when Yanal Ashmoz came out and fought Sam Patterson a few weeks ago? I do, and that's that gym, as well as an early career Khabib Nurmagomedov.
I'm just curious, do you look at this as the step up in competition that I do? Like, I think this is a major step up from the Devin Clark he saw the last time out.
Oh,
I just think, like, Dustin Jacoby, again, like you had said, Devin Clark didn't look all that durable in that fight. That's all I'm going to say.
It's
Dustin Jacoby, you got to hit pretty hard to get him to stop throwing his own boxing combinations forward.
And if you think of it for a guy like Dustin Jacoby, it's the biggest, like, middle finger of a reset because, okay, you go on a run, you beat Ledette Grecian, really close fight. Kutsalaba 10-8 first round, and then Jacoby wins the next two. Knocks out Darren Stewart, who was at the end of his UFC career. Has a good fight against John Allen. Looked great against Oleshchuk. Against Dawoon Jung, he goes out there and picks his boxing shots, plays hand fighting, and knocks him out in the first round. And then against Khalil Roundtree, most people thought that Jacoby won that fight overwhelmingly. So to go from beating Khalil Roundtree Jr., to then now facing an undefeated guy who throws a ton of power. And the last decision win for Mirzakhanov was against a pro kickboxer in Guto Inoshent. So that's kind of a weird one matchmaking-wise. You got to put guys together outside of the top 15 to give them their shot.
But Jacoby's been number 16 for 3 years now.
Yeah,
like, at a certain point, give the man his
due. It's really weird. So another fellow happy birthday to Dustin Jacoby. Just turned 35 in the last week. Jacoby, the decent favorite in this matchup. Mirzakhanov, the underdog. We have a look at the Tapology votes, Matt. And I'm perplexed. I don't know where it's going to be. You want to set the over-under?
Sure. I'm going to set it at 74.5% Jacoby.
I'm going to say under.
Okay.
And we have a look at it. It's under 1,097 total votes, 65% Jacoby, 75% by decision. For the 35% that I have, Mirzakhanov, 49% by knockout. Matt, I mean, Dustin Jacoby, 2-1 favorite in the matchup, and I'm thinking I picked him in just about every single UFC fight he's had since he's been back, except for maybe like one. So Dustin Jacoby, I love the strike on the outside of the matchup for him.
So you're picking him in this one? It sounds like it. I just think there's two very obvious issues that Mirzakhanov's going to run into. He's fighting a man who's way bigger than him.
Who has good cardio.
Exactly. Who is pretty durable. And who throws good volume for the light heavyweight division. I know against Khalil Roundtree Jr. it might not have been the best showcase of that. But when Jacoby is fighting another guy who will go out there and strike with him, especially a guy with the low volume of a Mirzakhanov, I can see Jacoby really feeling himself, if you will. And I do think we will see a lot more combinations out of him. I think the kicks will be essential. But the 65-35, I think, is a pretty fair split on Tapology. You know, like, I think there's a decent chance where Mirzakhanov could use some of that foot speed, get on the inside, land a big hook. It's just I haven't seen Jacoby go down from one shot yet, so I don't think it's going to happen now.
I mean, Max Griesen was able to do it in that matchup.
He got up, though.
That's why I thought Griesen was able to get it done. And at the same time, Griesen was able to pressure him up against the cage, make it gritty, take away that space.
He didn't do a lot in between that, though.
And Kutsalaba had a lot of success with the takedowns, too. I'll go with the big underdog in Azamat Mirzakhanov. I'm going to completely flip my pole of thinking. This got me snake-bitten last weekend and going, hey, I'm going to take all these finishers to beat the longer kind of more drawn out type of fighters on the card, and it didn't work out for me. But in this one, I'm gonna go with Azamat Mirzakhanov. Hopefully he's able to kind of get himself into the fight, because Dustin Jacoby's one of those guys that's gonna get you into a fight with really good volume on the outside. I think this is an amazing fight. We're split on the pick. I'm going with the guy based in New Jersey now, and Azamat Mirzakhanov, you're going with Colorado's own Dustin Jacoby. We need to hear from you down below in the comments section on this one. Let us know who you have in the matchup, Matt, and in the co-main event, possible fight of the night. You get Edson Barboza Jr. taking on Billy Quarantillo. Should be a great fight. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
Hey, Fight Night Picks fans, you like leg kicks? I can hear you through the screen. You said yes. You like boxing? Yeah. You like Fight of the Nights? I know you do. These are stupid, redundant questions, but coming up this weekend, Matt, in the co-main event at featherweight, Edson Barboza Jr. looking to be that gatekeeper again. He's going to be taking on Billy Quarantillo, who beat a big-time former hyped-up prospect in Alexander Hernandez last time out. Let me tell you, Hernandez looked great in the first round. He really did. Yeah. The wrestling was there. The boxing was there. He got tired in the second round. It was his first ever fight at featherweight. And Billy Q took over. His boxing looked amazing. Finished him. It was a TKO standing due to an accumulation of damage and punches for Billy Q. And Hernandez's face was a mess at the end of that one. And for Barboza Jr., I can't say as many good things about his last time out against Bryce Mitchell.
I have two really important questions for you in this fight.
Yes.
Does Edson Barboza's chin hold up to a one-punch shot from Billy Q? And does Billy Q have enough one-punch power to hurt a guy like Barboza? Because I think both these guys are on a very fine kind of seesaw right now. To where Billy Q is a guy who we talk about his volume all the time. And of course, the volume is at the forefront of his game. But he does have good pop at the end of his shots. And for Barboza, he at one point had an extremely nice chin, and one of the better ones, but we have seen that as his career has progressed, and at featherweight, not at lightweight, some shots have been able to hurt him that otherwise wouldn't have been able to, so I know that's a bit of a loaded question, but do you think Barboza will be able to withstand some of those flurries from a guy like Billy Q?
I think he's going to try and stay outside in the kicking range, and Billy Q's one of those guys, like Brennan Allen, like Chris Curtis, and for Brennan Allen, he took us, Matt, and he went, put you on a poster, and so did Billy Q in that Instagram story, but I was harsh on Quarantillo when he fought Gavin Tucker, and the body kick and different things, they really did kind of zap the cardio, but we've seen before, and we've seen since, that Billy's cardio is really good, and in a three-round fight, I don't expect there to be any issues against a guy like Barboza, but for Barboza to kind of hammer home your point, his last time out, it was what, a right straight and a left hook that landed for Bryce Mitchell? And drop Barboza. And I know he popped right back up to his feet and then he got taken down out of that. But you look at the final scores out of that fight, you think it was like, and it was,
like a mollywop.
30-25, 30-26, 30-27. It was really bad for Barboza. He couldn't defend any of the takedowns. He got beat in the striking. The left hand wasn't talking to the right hand and he couldn't get his own striking game working. And when I talk about Barboza's leg kicks, look at the leg to body combination out of the kicks that he had against a guy like Dan Hooker when he put him on a poster. It was working out amazingly. And that's kind of my big point for this video that I want to get across. Billy Quarantillo against some of these higher level guys. Against Hernandez, 87 significant strikes, 9 leg kicks. Against Burgos, 164 significant strikes, 7 leg kicks.
We also got to say, though, Edson Barboza beat the brakes off Shane Burgos.
Gabriel Benitez, 100 strikes, 7 leg kicks. Tucker, 81 strikes, 7 leg kicks. And against Kyle Nelson, Canadian, 79 total strikes or significant strikes, 12 leg kicks. Quarantillo doesn't throw a lot of kicks. He cuts the distance with really nice movement on the feet, but also hooks to really break things down, get his opponent behind the block line, and really take over. Pop head, pop body. Doesn't throw kicks. Edson throws the kitchen sink of kicks. I mean, if we were throwing, we were trying to lob the vessel, he'd be taking that sink and he'd be throwing it out there at you. But for Barboza, at this point in his career, does he have the foot speed to get out of the way of against a guy like Quarantillo? That's my big question mark in this one.
And this is where I'm going to throw another curveball at you. If Barboza plants his feet, I don't think there's a world where Billy Q wants to just stand in the pocket with Edson Barboza. Like, Edson, we talk about the kicks, and yeah, they're great. When Edson Barboza just plants his feet, though, and throws his hands, he has incredible hand speed combinations and power. Like,
but his chin's not there anymore.
I know it's not, but down Billy Q class. Is a guy who throws a lot of volume and leaves those openings for a guy like Barboza. If Barboza starts mixing in that left hook to the body and going left hook up top, because he likes same side attacks, and we don't see that often in MMA. It's a lot of you throw a jab, followed by a right hand, followed by a left hook. Edson will throw four straight left hooks to the body and to the head, and really mix in his combinations. This is one of those fights where I think it's going to be really one-sided for one guy. It's just really difficult to say who it's going to be one-sided for, because I do think there's a world where Edson goes in there, throws the leg kick, makes Billy a much more stationary target, and then starts to pick him apart with the boxing. But like you had mentioned, if Edson doesn't have the footwork, if he does get himself caught up against the cage, we've seen Billy Q. He's like a shark in the water. Once he senses blood, it's pretty much over. He has great finishing instinct. Like the Alexander Hernandez fight, the second Hernandez seemed like he had missed a step, Billy Q, it's just like a light went off in his head and he put the pressure on him. And I could see a very similar performance by Billy Quarantillo in this fight, but that's what makes it so difficult to predict, because I could see either guy going out there and getting a knockout at basically any moment throughout this fight.
New Brunswickers and Mainers might like this, or they might really not like it. So it all depends, but do you think you'd just be going swimming in the Passamaquoddy Bay wearing a wetsuit and you done it, it's Billy Q coming up at you?
You could.
When I look at this matchup, Matt, the great white sharks go to Passamaquoddy Bay quite a bit now, but when you look at this matchup, Matt, for Barboza, the last two fights, the sample size are awful. I mean, Giga was able to cut the distance, go body head, work his boxing, and finish him.
That Shane Burgos fight just stands out in my mind because of how similar Billy Q and Shane Burgos are with their fighting style.
And in the fight that Shane Burgos had against Billy Q, Shane was able to really pull away with his own leg.
To me, those guys are very close. Like, if they fought 10 times, there's a good chance that they just end up breaking even 5-5.
Wow.
If Edson Barboza fought Shane Burgos 10 times, you would not want to see that fight after, like, twice.
So we throw it on over to you guys. YouTube community tab, you guys help us out with these ones. And right now, like 705 total votes. The poll went out 15 hours ago. 54% going with Quarantillo, 46% with Barboza. Out of the comments section, Tommy saying, Billy is crazy durable. Edson, it's hard and fast, but he's older now. Edson's also durable too, but he fades. I'll take Billy on this one. T. Kin saying, Edson, too much mileage under his hood. And I'll go with one more. Hot Dogs is always out there. Edson fought the murderer's row, so the record doesn't worry me one bit. The worsening chin gives me concern. And Hot Dogs made a point of putting that on a separate line. Edson by leg kick, TKO for old time's sake. So people kind of all over the place. The votes with Billy Q. Edson also getting his due because, listen, the guy's been around forever. He's a part of that Teenage Wasteland Bob O'Reilly intro where he lands the leg kick on Terry Edom. You know how good the kicks are from Barboza.
Leg kick, the wheel kick.
Yeah, that's what I meant to say, sorry. But when you do focus on this one, try not to go galaxy brain. I have a hard time on the pick.
Edson Barboza could Dan Hooker Billy Q, and I wouldn't be surprised at all if I'm being completely honest. Like, Edson has had about 9 of these fights in his career, and granted, he doesn't win them all. But when he does, he kind of proves that, like, hey, what are we doing here, guys? Like, I know Barboza's not going to go out there and beat everybody in the top 5, but he's going to make all those fights competitive. He's going to make a great account of himself no matter what the stylistic matchup is. This guy fought Khabib Nurmagomedov, got destroyed for like 12 and a half minutes, but somehow in the last 2 minutes of that fight is throwing wheel kicks at Khabib, like still trying to get the win. So Edson is cut from that cloth, but I just think since I feel like I have seen him. I won't say that I'm 100% right, but I think Edson has lost that half a step to where Billy Q can capitalize if he does sense any kind of danger with Edson. And I think if he does get him up against the cage, look for a lot of those flurries.
I'll go with Billy, but I don't want to see him switch stances in this fight, and that's kind of scary. And you know what's wild? Billy Quarantillo is 3 years younger than Edson Barboza. That feels wild. So both of us going with the former King of the Cage man, Billy Quarantillo in the matchup. Those boxing combinations, cutting the cage. This is going to be an amazing fight. You want a striker's paradise. I know Billy's more apt to go to the wrestling than Barboza is, but it is an amazing one. Make sure you check out that main event. Max Holloway's taking on Arnold Allen. Lot to say on that one. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks, we always say.
Let's get into it.
It. Coming up this weekend, the main event. We're talking about two of the best featherweights that are out there right now. Max Holloway taking on Arnold Allen. As always, one half of your host, you do, Craig Allen. Twitter and Instagram, at Craig Allen FNP. With me to my left, to your right, Matt Allen. Respective socials, Matt Allen FNP. We make it easy, just like last weekend. Look at that. You never thought. Just the cheap old Kelvin Gastelum UFC shirt. I'm breaking it out. We had a crazy win for a guy coming back. And in this weekend's main event, Matt, when you look at this matchup between Holloway and Arnold Allen, Max Holloway definitely needs one of those crazy comeback, get on the horse type wins, because his last time out against Alexander Volkanovski, three fights. How'd the first fight go, Matt? Really quick. Really close.
But Volkanovski won the first fight.
Second fight. What'd
you think? Close. I thought Holloway won the second one.
Third fight, 50-45 out there. Or maybe a 49-46. But Alexander Volkanovski was able to go out there and put on a masterclass, and he's just able to continue that role at 145. So when you look at this matchup, Matt, between these two guys, a lot to say about the matchup, and just so glad that you could join us on this one. If you haven't subscribed already, you definitely should. You can toss us a like. It's appreciated. But when you look at this one, Matt, Arnold Allen's had that gradual rise up. He's really dealt with a lot of injuries throughout his career. I know it was much talked about, the hand injury after the Nick Lentz fight, but hand injuries as they've gone on, even after the Calvin Kattar fight. And obviously it's disappointing the way the Kattar fight ended, because Kattar at the end of the first round goes for a flying knee, lands awkwardly and falls on his leg. Second round starts off and he takes a leg kick and then falls down. The fight's over. But Arnold Allen, you can see such a progression in his boxing as this thing's gone on. He hasn't lost in years and years and years. 2014 was the last loss against Marcin Rocek that was on The Ultimate Fighter Season 22. But when you look at it in this one, Matt, obviously Allen's facing kind of a similar test to his last fight. Calvin Kattar boxing on the outside. Obviously, we know what Holloway did against Kattar, so it's not a fair comparison.
He fights like a tsunami. Like, it's terrifying. Max Holloway, I think, as an opponent, is a more scary opponent to fight than Francis Ngannou. Because, yes, Francis is terrifying. If he hits you one time, it's over. But at least it's over after that one time. When you fight Max Holloway, it's like you're being tortured for 25 minutes. Like, it's terrible. I couldn't imagine how Calvin Kattar felt those last 5 minutes of that fight. Like, when Holloway is really in his flow and really being able to land his boxing combinations, there's not anything anybody in the UFC can do. Now, Volkanovski was able to make it kind of an IQ test more than just a boxing match, because Volkanovski is that smart. He got in the pocket and figured out, okay, Max might be a better just 1-2 boxer than me, but I have faster hands than him. So if I make this fight about a hand speed fight and not about just boxing, I can win this fight. And that's why he looks so good. You could tell. The second he figured that out, oh, my hands are faster than his, he crashed the distance, got on the inside, didn't even use the outside kicks as much, which had given him so much success in their first 10 rounds. It's just he knew he had that much success. But I have a big hot take about Arnold Allen. And people don't come here for hot takes, but this is what I have. There's a great baseball YouTube channel out there called Foolish Baseball. And years ago, we had one. It was that Andrelton Simmons is going to be in the Hall of Fame. Now, Andrelton Simmons fell off a cliff shortly after that video came out.
He's a free agent right now. And if the Pirates need a replacement for O'Neill Cruz, maybe he'll be the next man up.
He's not. But the guy isn't playing right now. And they thought he was going to be one of the all-time greats.
He's only like 33.
The point is, I actually think Arnold Allen is the most difficult matchup in this division for Alexander Volkanovski. I genuinely believe that. Now, I thought for the longest time, Josh Emmett was going to be the person to beat Max Holloway. Like, do you ever have fighters in the division where you think, okay, they might not get to the title, but if they ever do, everything they do well is just a good counter to what the champion has. I do think Arnold Allen is a bit of a difficult matchup for a guy like Volkanovski, because if Volkanovski does try to make it about hand speed, about that kind of inside game, Arnold Allen could play that inside game, and he has quite a bit of power. And the good thing about Allen is he doesn't get hit clean that often. I know you're going to say, oh, Matt, he got hit clean by Dan Hooker that one time. Yeah, after he had dropped him about six times, he got crazy reckless because the fight was basically over. For the most part, Arnold Allen does do a great job defensively, but that's what this fight's going to come down to, because if Holloway has any success in the first round, we'll have more in the second, more in the third, more in the fourth, more in the fifth. You know how Max Holloway fights. But if Allen can just be sound enough defensively and land his own power shots in those earlier rounds, I do think he can bank enough to make this fight competitive down the stretch. I just don't know how many more Holloway kind of all-time blitzes we're going to be able to see, because the Calvin Kattar fight itself was, it's so memorable because it was a surprise. You know, like, nobody thought Max Holloway was going to be able to come back and kind of look as good as he ever did. But for Holloway, I just wonder how many more times he's going to be able to have those types of performances. performances.
Yeah, and that was after two losses to Alexander Volkanovski that he looked so good. So for Max Holloway, obviously we know how good the career is. And we know the fact that he features so high up in UFC significant strikes all time. I mean, it's 2,975. That's number one. Number two, 1,801 by Frankie Edgar. And when it comes to total strikes, 3,217... GSP.
He also set a record for most significant strikes that broke his own record.
2,591 is GSP. And also for Max Holloway, third all time in total fight time, 50 minutes and 47 seconds. Max Holloway in the UFC is 19-7. He's had three fights against southpaws, and if you follow me on Twitter and you eat crayons, you think, oh, well, Arnold Allen's going to win this fight because of what Craig said. Max Holloway's 0-3 against UFC southpaws. And who did he fight, Craig? Give it away. Dustin Poirier twice and Conor McGregor once. So, again, the Dustin Poirier fight at the start, a well-rounded fight. The fight against Conor McGregor at the start, McGregor mixed in takedowns, fought a well-rounded fight.
But also, that fight was 10 years ago. You can't take a lot from it.
The second Dustin Poirier fight, obviously, it's up a weight class where the commentary is saying, even before the fight and as it's starting, this is Max Holloway's natural division. This is where we're going to see Max Holloway. What did Dustin Poirier do in the first round that Arnold Allen does exactly to a T? Philly shell defense, wait, throw counters and throw hooks.
The difference is, though, Arnold Allen can't throw at the range. Like, Poirier can close the distance with punches from really far away. Allen has to set his feet a lot more for that, I think, is the difference. I don't disagree with your point. I think it's very important to bring up. I think for Allen, I don't know if he's going to be able to hurt Holloway the same way Poirier was, because Poirier is, like, an all-time great power puncher, where Arnold Allen has good punching power. I just don't know if he's on that kind of list.
No, and he kind of took a knife and shoved it into my heart, because last night all I did was watch boxing videos on defense. But when I look at a guy like Arnold Allen, drops the lead hand, brings it up, defends really well, he's able to parry and counter, like the show that we have here in Fight Night Picks, and that's how he's able to land. That's what he did to Calvin Kattar. That's what he did against Sadiq Yusuf when he had his great exchanges. He's a southpaw that fights in a similar way to a guy who has two wins over Max Holloway at this current juncture, and I'm sure he's watching those Poirier fights trying to gain little bits and pieces. Now, for Holloway in the fights against Poirier, especially the second one that I'm going to focus in on, and I know it's upper weight class against one of the best boxers that you're going to find in MMA. Hold on. Maybe Arnold Allen's going to be there. I don't know that yet. But in that one, Poirier rocked him the first round. Poirier rocked him in the second round. Set the tone from the start. And out of his power, it limited the volume and the ability for Holloway to throw counters. Not a lot of kicks in that fight. Arnold Allen's not a very kick-heavy type of fighter either. The thing that scares me...
He has insane leg kicks, though.
He has good leg kicks. He doesn't just throw a ton of kicks. Like, boxing is at the forefront of Arnold Allen's game, is what I'm getting at. But when I look at Arnold Allen... His last fight was his first five-round fight, and we saw a round and 15 seconds to the Kattar injury. This is his second five-round fight. Max Holloway's the cardio king. Max Holloway keeps the five-round pace.
He is the cardio king.
He is the cardio king. Throw that hat on him. I don't know how Arnold Allen's going to make out, and that was a big point that I had against Kattar, because even just a few fights ago against Sadiq Yusuf, he was completely done in the UFC's apex at the end of that third round, to where there was a shot that Sadiq Yusuf had a win, or at least somewhat so. So Allen's been brought up. He's had these continually better fights. He was able to rally in that fight against Sadiq Yusuf. Went through and going back.
And he was looking good against Kattar before the ultimate injury, too.
Oh, he won that first round.
Yeah, it's not like he was getting his ass whooped for 4 minutes and then an injury just so happened. Like, he did look very strong earlier on in that fight. And that's what I do like about Allen. Does he ever just look like he's stagnant in his progress? No, it does seem like he does add a very major component to his game, time in and time out. And if we continue to see that, like, he's only 29. If he beats Max Holloway, I don't know what is next for him, but you'd have to assume a title shot. Like, only the best of things happen in your career if you could beat a guy like Max Holloway, because he is an all-time great, and he still probably is in his prime. I'm just curious, how much of that prime does he have left? Because the thing about Holloway is, you look, oh, only 31 years old. He was in the UFC in his early 20s, though, and he's been fighting in a lot of five-round fights, a lot of miles on him at this point. So I do worry about the miles on Max Holloway, but I still rely a lot on his skills. We saw him fight Yair Rodriguez, who is going to be fighting for a title in what should be an amazing fight against Alexander Volkanovski. And yes, he faced a little bit of adversity against Yair Rodriguez, but it was still, for the most part, the old Max Holloway that we all know.
And the funny thing is, and that's why I switched this camera, because again, I'm talking to you out there. And if you're listening on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, you don't get the same experience, but I'm talking to you right now. Fight fans are really fickle. Fight up, fight down. When you look at Holloway's last time out against Volkanovski, he got beat really soundly. You might buy low there. Arnold Allen looked amazing his last time out. I'm going to make a comparison. Arnold Allen's done something that I like out of fighters. Give me that glimpse. Show me that fight camp. On Arnold Allen's YouTube page, he's starting to use it more. He's giving you the behind the scenes. Like Adrian Yanez did last time out when he fought Rob Font. There were so many chronicles of his fight camp, getting ready for it. And obviously, Yanez has been kind of all over Twitter and apologetic. It's not your fault, man. You lost the fight. Like, don't be hard on yourself. Arnold Allen, same thing over on his YouTube. Getting ready, eating right, training, lifting weights.
He's in insane shape, to be fair. Like, Arnold Allen is yoked up.
Yeah, and he's lifting lighter weights, but you could tell he's doing, like, lightweight, high rep, trying to get that, you know, cardio and that muscle expenditure in there. So he's got lactic acid levels like he's Randy Couture. But when you look at it for Arnold Allen, his dad's in incredible shape. I wouldn't want to fight that guy.
He's got some help, though, to be fair, that Arnold Allen doesn't have.
He's as red as my sweater. But Arnold Allen's dad, I love to see that guy on camera. And for Allen, he didn't want to tire his legs out, so we'll see how that goes for him. But when you look at a matchup like this, Matt, you have an all-time great against a great up-and-comer. Obviously, he shares the nickname with us, and he's a part of the Commonwealth, so you kind of have to blur the lines.
But Max Holloway is also Canada's like favorite fighter.
The 10th Island is Toronto. Yeah,
Max
Holloway's 2-0 in Toronto. He fought there against Brian Ortega.
And
the
Frankie
Edgar. Yeah, the Anthony Pettis fight.
But Edmonton for Frank Edgar. So there you go. He's fought Canada four times because he fought Charles Oliveira in Saskatoon, of all places.
It's wild.
Max Holloway, honorary Canadian.
A Canadian
perhaps.
Legend. So when you look at it again, the Southpaw lineage for Holloway hasn't been able to beat one yet. And you might go, well, Craig, Will Chope was a switch fighter. Will Chope was an orthodox fighter in that fight. And you go, well, Craig, Brian Ortega fights Southpaw all the time. He didn't fight Southpaw in the fight against Max Holloway. If you go back and watch it, the votes on this one in our YouTube community tab, 941 of them, 55% Holloway, 45% Arnold Allen. Big money, I'm going to say. Allen, 10-0 in the UFC, so slept on. I don't know who's sleeping on him now.
Well, he's not like of the level of some of the other big names, because the big names in the featherweight division are Josh Emmett, Yair Rodriguez, Volkanovski. Like, they're big
are people lining up to buy Kelvin Gastelum shirts and Josh Emmett shirts?
Josh Emmett's main event at multiple fight nights, and he's been in multiple, like, fight of the year contenders. So, yeah, I'd say Josh Emmett's a big name. Like, Arnold Allen is starting that journey.
Chuz says on our YouTube, can't wait. I'm going to be there in KC for my first event. First loss, Arnold Allen evolves so much fight by fight. Would not be surprised if he knocks out Max. And I'll go with one more. Ronnie Perez, Max should never have taken this fight. That's the one thing that I don't understand out of our YouTube community and out of the people on Twitter. They're either Arnold Allen's gained so much he's going to knock Max out, or Max never should have taken this fight. Like, it's stupid of him for him to take a fight against Arnold Allen. You got to fight who they give you at this point. But
you don't if you're Max. Like, I'm going to push. Like, you're Max Holloway. You don't have to fight Arnold Allen. You can move up to lightweight and fight anybody, and it's a money fight. You can fight just big names in this division. Like, Max Holloway's a guy who doesn't have to fight whoever the UFC gives him. He's one of the greatest fighters ever.
Do you think he wins this fight coming up this weekend?
I do. I think I've been really high on Arnold Allen. You guys know that if you've watched any of our videos in the past. I feel like I picked him in every single one of his fights as of late. But I just think Max Holloway, he gets stronger as the fight goes on, unless you can put an absurd amount of damage on him. And Dustin Poirier has knocked out Justin Gaethje, has hurt Max Holloway.
Had those Eddie Alvarez fights.
Yeah, he has some of the greatest punching power we've ever seen. Although Arnold Allen is a primary boxer from the Southpaw position, I do not think he is like a one-of-one outlier like a Poirier. For those reasons, I think Arnold Allen can make a great account of himself. I mentioned the leg kicks for a reason. I think those will be very important to try to slow down some of that movement of Holloway. But at the end of the day, I do have Max blessed Holloway.
Yeah, the funny thing about Holloway's fight when he did fight Will Chope is that his boxing was carrying to the win, and I know that was Chope's only fight in the UFC. The thing that I liked out of Holloway in that one, he two-hand up, faked the takedown, and then land some more combinations out of it. So for Holloway in a matchup like this, Poirier can keep it on a level, even though he might look a little tired. He still has it in the chamber. I haven't seen Arnold Allen in a five-round atmosphere other than that fight against Calvin Kattar. Allen's looked amazing in these last two fights. I didn't necessarily love it against Sadiq Youssef. Against Nick Lentz, I thought he looked great. He defended all those takedowns.
Like, Youssef's a really good fighter. You're not going to win every round against him. Like, you're going to get tired trying to beat a guy like Sadiq Youssef. He's really good.
I will say this. The one thing that I'm eager to see out of Arnold Allen in this matchup, this could be an X factor. We've talked leg kicks the whole darn time. Arnold Allen against old Gilbert Melendez. I know Gilbert was a strike force champ, and he was able to get around the top of that mountain, a 209 original. Arnold Allen with his leg kicks in that fight was disgusting. And against a guy like Max Holloway, who leans in on his lead leg, it's out there to be hit. Now, usually he counters off the boxing on that one, but watch out for that in this matchup. So both of us in the matchup, I'm going with Max Holloway as well. I like the boxing and the striking on the outside. I like the five-round cardio. If Arnold Allen pulls out a win, it's not going to surprise Fightin' Eight Picks, but you guys are doing a great job here with the channel. The subscriptions were up last week. The likes were up last week. We're really eager to move forward. Next weekend, you have Pavlovich taking on Curtis Blaydes, and then it's Cejudo against Aljamain Sterling. Somebody asked me here recently, like, how are the fights? Like, I've been watching. Are they good? Oh, yeah. Boy. Like, they have actually heated up. We'll be tough when we need to be tough, but they're really stacked here
this
lately.
This is a great fight night card, too, to get you excited for some of those ones coming up.
Yeah, only a couple of debuts on this one, and the debuting fighters are Gaston Bolaños, Muay Thai Zone. Make sure you check out the keeping score that's in this series here on the YouTube channel. But you also have like that possible retirement fight between a couple of legends, Zach Cummings and Ed Herman, guys that fought with Strikeforce, with the Ultimate Fighter, Clay Guida, an original who's in the OC's Hall of Fame, Kutsalaba Bozer's a lot of fun, and Munoz Gutierrez as well. So a lot to really look forward to that's on this card.
Max Holloway for 5 years was locked behind a $90 paywall. Like, he's that good of a fighter for a reason.
$90?
Well, just like Max Holloway, you can only watch on pay-per-view for the longest time. Like, he's not a free Saturday night kind of card type of a fighter. Like, Max Holloway is an all-time great. I fully expect him to be a Hall of Famer the second he retires. He's already done that much in his career. But this is an incredible main event and entire card we have waiting for us.
A big-time card at Fight Night Picks over on Instagram. Craig Allen, Matt Allen, FNP as well. Make sure you check in here on Saturday, 2 hours before the prelims. Subject to change here. You can check out Question Mark Kicks offering up those final picks and predictions. 5 fighters on this card moving up and down in weight classes. That's really important. So make sure you check out that show on Saturday. Keep it locked in with Fight Night Picks. We always say,
let's get into it.